Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. We have a quorum, so we're going to get started. And I'm Senator Jackie Dingfelder. This is our last hearing for the interim before we start session next year. So we'll have we have a few members that are going to be leaving, so before they leave today, we'll be saying a few words. I'm very sad to say my vice chair is moving on to greener pastures, should we say? And so this will be his last hearing today, so we'll ask him to say a few words before he sneaks out. But what I'm going to do is open up a hearing. We have a lot of very interesting information to share today, and just a reminder that this is just an informational hearing, and we'll be having the official hearings on bills when we come into session next year. So just for folks who are coming here and testifying today, we may be asking you to come back when we have hearings on the bill next session. So just want to let you know. But everything that you say today is on the record, and this is background information for our discussions next session. We will have two new members of this committee starting next session, so you'll have to re-educate some of the members on these issues. So with that, I'm going to open up an informational meeting on a plastic bag ban bill. I'm going to ask the chief sponsors of the bill to do an introduction. So my colleagues, Senator Mark Cass and Senator Jason Atkinson. Gentlemen?
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder. I'm going to leave the presentations to the experts here today, and we do have lots of experts. You know, by way of background, you know, this came up in the session earlier this year. I think we ran out of time but before we could bring it to a vote. But since then, there's been a lot of hard work in improving the legislation that's out there today, LC 688, which will be pre-session filed into the next session. Essentially, what it is it will ban plastic bags next year at most retailers and replace them with recycled paper bags that would be available for a 5-cent charge. And recycled paper bags are mostly made in Oregon. Plastic bags are all made outside of Oregon. And because of that, there is a strong business and economic interest in doing this. I was pleasantly surprised by the business interests who have signed on to support this, from our recyclers that we're going to hear from grocers, from Fred Meyers, all the way on down and including the paper industry here in this state. So it feels pretty good. It feels like a 1-2 punch in this next session. We will be able to do something for business while also helping Oregon's environment. I think it's incumbent upon one of the West Coast states to be a leader in this movement and say, you know, we have to stop flushing plastic into the Pacific Ocean. And this country has been doing that for too long, and so I'm anxious to get going.
Great. Thank you. Senator Atkinson?
Well, I am very excited to work with Senator Hass, who this has been a year and a half together so far, at least, I think, on this issue. But for some reason, this generates less than bipartisan results or scare. And so what I'd like to do is talk to both sides. First, on the left, yes, there's tremendous value here. And I will tell you that my interest is very narrow, which is the health of Oregon's rivers. And having experienced plastic bags and what plastic bags do and their like on rivers, I think that this was very easy. On the right, let me tell you that Senator Hass is absolutely correct. We don't make plastic bags in Oregon. We make paper bags in Oregon. And there's a lot of communities in Oregon that would really like to have additional sales being made out of paper. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm delighted to work with Senator Hass. And some of you might know that outside of the legislature, I have a fairly healthy wanderlust, and I was in Africa recently, and there in Africa, my heart turned to Senator Hass as I brought him a gift, because in the country of South Africa, they have banned plastic bags, and they've gone to this, and so I brought Senator Hass's very own Woolworths, straight from South Africa, shopping bag, because they don't know about, they banned it a long time ago, and even in some of the more poor areas of South Africa that you might be familiar with, at least by way of television, they got rid of the plastic bag problem there. So they've got a long way to go, but they seem to have figured this out. And so here is a Woolworths bag, again, presented to Senator Haass.
World Cup theme.
And so anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. So with that, I am going to call up some of the folks who would like to present on this bill. And I'm going to ask folks if you can keep your comments fairly brief, because you will be coming back and probably repeating these when we have new committee members. But certainly very interested to hear your thoughts. And if you do have handouts, if you can please hand them to our committee staff, and she will make sure that everybody up here at the dais receives them, and hopefully we'll have a couple more committee members that will be joining us shortly. With that, I'd like to invite up Representative Vic Gilliam, one of our colleagues, to speak on this, and then we'll call up some panels after that. Welcome, Representative. It's a pleasure to have you here this morning.
Nice to be here. For the record, Vic Gilliam from District 18, and I'm happy just to briefly add to what both senators have already articulated and add my support. I would say to my friend, Senator Haass, you're not the only one that has been left holding the bag with Senator Atkinson, but
that's it. That's all you got this morning?
Madam Chair, I keep your committee in line. I'd appreciate it.
It's impossible.
Take a look at this list that you're going to hear from. It's already been alluded to. And, it is bipartisan. It is from the left or the right, however you want to say it. And I wanted to add my voice. No legislation that I've seen come out of this building is perfect, but this is a great foundation and a great start. What I like about it is that Senator Haass has particularly taken the time to bring together folks. You can use all the cliches that we use in this building, but the stakeholders, but he brought them together early. And so I appreciate the fact that you would take a look at this bill. The rift between rural and urban is huge. I grew up in Multnomah County, but for the last 12 years I've lived in Silverton. And for four of those, I've represented the area. It doesn't take very long, as the chair knows, riding her bicycle, to get out of Multnomah County and into rural Oregon. And this is an opportunity for the state to act, for us as legislators to represent the whole state on an issue that's very important to the environmental issues of plastic in our rivers and in the ocean that Senator Atkinson alluded to. And not to allow Multnomah County necessarily to draw a line in the sand, but actually to say, and I think this is one of the things that Senator Haass has been very good at, to say, hold on a minute. It's important that we get a chance to put together a policy on an issue this important from a state level first, so that we don't end up with an unnecessary regulatory patchwork. So I'm eager to be helpful if I can, but I appreciate the fact you're taking a look at this early and with the kind of bipartisan support. If you look at the list, you might even say bipolar folks that you're going to hear from today. So thanks for the opportunity, and good luck with this very important piece of legislation.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative? Or do you want to grill him a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the holiday season.
Yeah. We'll be kind to you. Thank you for coming today. We'll look forward to working with you. Thank you. So with that, I'm going to call up folks. There is no special order. I'm just calling off the list and just ask people, since we have three chairs, if you can come up together. Mike Ellis from Fred Meyers. Is it Stash Pace?
I think so.
Surfrider Foundation. And I know Brock Howell is on his way, so we'll ask Sue Marshall to come up. If Sue's here. Thank you. Mr. Ellis, would you like to get started?
Sure.
And for the record, just a reminder, if you can please state your name and the organization you're with, or if you're a citizen, your address and what town you're coming from, that's very important for the record. Thank you.
Well, good morning, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, and members of the committee. I'm Mike Ellis with Fred Meyer Stores, and I'm in Portland, Oregon. We're located in downtown Portland. Thank you for having me. I'm going to read my prepared remarks, if that's okay.
Actually, if you could just summarize, because that would be helpful instead of reading.
Sure,
because are you handing us a copy of your remarks as well?
I have not brought one. I can
send
one down, though.
Yeah, that would be great.
This is actually pretty quick. As you, I think you all know Fred Meyer, we're in four states in the Northwest. We have 30,000 employees and 13,000 here in Oregon. I'm here to tell you today that Fred Meyer does support plastic ban legislation, and that we understand will be introduced here in the upcoming session. We began offering reusable bags in 2007 and have sold or given away well over 5 million bags to date. This year it appears that our customers will use a reusable bag about 10% more than they did last year, so we're converting folks to reusable bags. Our customers have clearly embraced the move away from disposable bags. The only complaint that we get is they can't remember to grab them from their car, which is pretty typical. So we tried to sign our parking lots and remind people to bring their bags with them. For several years now, we've seen plastic bag plastic bag wave roll across many of our states where we do business. Several cities or counties have passed or talked seriously about passing various forms of legislation. Some would love to ban plastic altogether. Some would like to ban plastic and paper. Some would like to charge a fee of different amounts. So herein lays the problem that I hope you will help us solve. It's critical that there be just one uniform law across the state as it pertains to disposable bags, as we call them. And it's critical that the law includes incentives for people to switch to reusable bags. Plastic bags have been a part of our business for more than 30 years, so removing them can, of course, be done, but we have to figure out a way to continue to serve our customers in a way that's easy for them. To that end, Fred Meyer took action last summer, and we piloted a 10-store ban of plastic bags in Portland. I think you probably heard about that. On August 1st, we took plastic out completely of those stores, with one exception. We kept the big plastic bags that pillows and things go into because there was no other way to get those articles out of our stores. Our biggest lesson has been that when you remove plastic, customers don't automatically switch to reusable bags. We wish they would, but they haven't. We learned this year that we removed plastic bags from our Hawthorne store in the fall of 2009. That store is a LEED certified store. I don't know if you had to throw that in, but seriously, when you remove plastic bags, the majority of customers switch to paper. Regardless of the other options that you have, they switch to paper. And it's really not my place here today to debate paper versus plastic, but I can tell you with certainty that any legislation removing plastic must incent customers to switch to reusable bags. That Hawthorne store on 39th and Hawthorne in Portland, that's our longest-running experiment in eliminating plastic. In 2008, when there was both plastic and paper in the store, the Hawthorne store used a little over 230,000 paper bags. In 2009, when we removed the plastic on the later half of the year, that store used 1.4 million bags, paper. So it went from 230,000 to 1.4 million. So it's a huge increase in the use of paper. And as you can see, we achieved great success in eliminating millions of plastic bags, but we really only shifted the problem from one disposable bag to another. So we're seeing an increase in paper bag use in those 10 stores in Portland where we removed plastic. In the 5 months prior to the day we pulled the plastic, those 10 stores used about 2.1 million paper bags. And since then, they're up to almost 5 million paper bags. So people really aren't jumping to reusable. They are just using more paper. Bottom line is this. I believe any legislation we have needs to be successful. It will need to contain an incentive for customers to use a recyclable bag. I understand the direction of the committee and the legislature is to reduce or eliminate plastic. Fred Meyer has already taken the first steps to test the waters. The draft legislation you're considering looks very good to us as a company. Creates a fair playing field for all the retailers. Helps make it easy for consumers to switch by allowing us to provide alternatives. And it provides an incentive for customers to switch to reusable bags. Thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ellison. The store that you're talking about is only 11 blocks out of my district, but I've visited it many times. I do have a quick question for you, because I don't know if you still, I think you still have the policy where you actually provide an incentive, not a disincentive, for people to bring reusable bags. Is that correct? The 5 cents off their grocery bill?
We've done that for many years.
So my question to you is, do you think a disincentive would work better than an incentive? Because you have many years of experience providing that 5 cent per bag, I believe, incentive.
Well, I think the 5 cents is important, but I think most people that have environmental concerns do it either way. I don't think the 5 cents is, really that big a deal to most customers. I do think that nickel would push people towards using recyclable bags, though, if there is a charge for a bag at the store.
And one other follow-up question. You talked about the large increase. I wrote down from 230,000 paper bags to 1.4 paper bags. Did you track how many people were bringing in their own bags? Do you have a sense was that 5 or 10%?
Well, the Hawthorne store, for example, we have a very high usage of reusable bags there, a lot of walk-in traffic and a lot of bus traffic. So it's probably higher than most would be. The rural areas, obviously, are a lot lower. But I don't know the percentage exactly of those that are bringing recycled bags.
Do you track that at all?
We know what we sell, but we don't know. Well, I think we gave away over 1 million nickels last year in our company.
Hmm.
So it adds up pretty quick.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other questions? Yeah. Senator Hess?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank President Ellis and Fred Myers for not only being one of the state's biggest employers, but for joining this effort. I don't think we'd have this much momentum were it not for you stopping plastic bags in Portland and trying to work together. So appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Great, thank you. And we have two senators that have joined us, Senator Przanski.
Good morning.
And Senator Boquist.
Good morning, ma'am.
Yep. Any questions from this end of the dais? Okay, great. Thank you.
Hello, Chair Dingfelder and members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. My name is Nastasia Pace. For the record, I'm the chair of the Surfrider Foundation Portland chapter. And I first wanted to mention that in regards to what he was saying, there was a disincentive in D.C. earlier this year that resulted in an 85% decrease in bags in the first month after the bill was instated. So the Surfrider Foundation is dedicated to protecting our oceans and beaches. And so for the past 4 years, the Oregon chapters have focused much of their efforts on Rise Above Plastic campaigns, such as Ban the Bag. And plastics are entering our waterways at an alarming rate. With 60 to 80% of all marine debris coming from land-based sources, we believe it is apparent to put in policies that create change and decrease plastics in our oceans. Plastics do not biodegrade ever, and through a process known as photodegradation, they break down into smaller and smaller pieces. And in the ocean, marine filter feeders often mistake those pieces for plankton, and when consumed, the plastics, organic chemicals, and pollutants bioaccumulate in the species tissue, making way into the marine food chain and eventually ours. Oregon chapters have performed hundreds of public outreach initiatives raising awareness on these issues. We've participated in 45 cleanups and distributed 25,000 reusable bags with the help of Solve. With these efforts, we have built a coalition of 75 Oregon businesses and received over 6,000 signatures in support of a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags. It is also with these efforts that the Newport chapter and the chapter of Portland have successfully worked with their cities to pass resolutions also in support of this legislation. So we believe a comprehensive statewide policy will be the most effective way to actually eliminate unnecessary plastics entering our oceans and really encourage consumers to shift towards reusables. So I, with the Surfrider Foundation, want to ask you guys for your support in helping Oregonians protect our ocean's legacy for the use and enjoyment of future generations, as many other cities and nations around the world have done.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Pace.
Thank you.
Why don't you go ahead, Sue, and then we'll see if there's any
Great.
Questions.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Audubon Society of Portland, Tualatin River Keepers, and Willamette River Keepers. I figured our collective membership is around 14,000. All three organizations are in support of a ban on plastic bags, single use at the retail level. We very much feel like we have a stake in this issue. As the bags take flight, they create visual pollution erosion along waterways. They end up in the streams, natural areas. There's a threat to wildlife in that, and it's particularly birds, become entangled with the plastic bags. They die. They, as they break down, they may mistake in some of these pieces for food and starve. And as they continue to travel down the streams and make their way into the ocean, they break down further, impacting aquatic species and never quite going away altogether. It wasn't so long ago that we weren't reliant on these plastic bags. We believe there are economical alternatives for reusable bags that, and we think that this is a fairly painless way to reduce our plastic waste and consumption of oil-based products. Participated in cleanups throughout the year. Removing plastic bags from the waste stream is one less thing we'll have to haul out of the streams. We believe there's a strong statewide momentum right now and encourage you to support this legislation, and would like to thank in particular Senator Hass and Senator Atkinson for their continued leadership on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question of Ms. Pace, if she would. You made mention the D.C. disincentive. Washington, D.C. and Congress and the federal government's not exactly a pillar of responsibility, whether they're Republicans or Democrats back there at all. So I'm not happy with either one of them. Having said that, though, you said the disincentive program had like an 85%. Can you just briefly give an overview of what the disincentive program was in D.C. that led to that?
And I think I also want to clarify, it's actually the city of Washington, D.C. It wasn't passed through Congress,
okay,
correct?
Yeah.
Which is a federal entity. But
okay,
so
it's the city. And I believe they instituted a 5-cent fee on both plastic and paper.
A 5-cent?
Or they banned plastic and put a 5-cent fee.
Is that correct?
A fee on both.
On both plastic and paper.
And I think, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was like an estimated they used 23 million plastic bags a month or something, and it went down 85% in the first month.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much for coming here this morning. Appreciate your input.
Thank
Next you. Up, Joe Gilliam, Bill Gardner, and Jeff Murray.
Oh, this should be
advanced. Morning, gentlemen. Joe, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joe Gilliam, President of Northwest Grocery Association, representing grocers all over the Northwest. I think I'll leave most of my testimony was said by President Mike Ellis and Fred Myers. I'm a member of ours, a former board chair, and he has the most experience in terms of our members, but our whole membership is in support of the concepts in 688, the LC draft. It's been a long, long road. We want to thank both the senators up here to my right in their work in pulling people together. Senator Hass, we have gotten to know each other probably far better than we ever thought we would in many meetings sitting over talking about bags. It's not a sexy issue. It's not one you're just drawn to go do, but I tell you, the experience has been good, and it's been unbelievable. We've been at this association about 5 years. Trying to find a way and a path to put all this together. It seems like every time you pull on one end, something bad comes out the other, and you just keep trying to solve this Rubik's Cube. And I believe that the bill that you have before you finally puts together the best pieces to make it work, not only for the environmental side and the concerns of eliminating plastic in the rivers and the oceans, but also a comprehensive approach that's going to work at the retail level and not enrage the consumers, and it addresses their needs. And it recognizes it's going to be a slow process of behavioral change. You're talking about 30 years of behavior here. And that needs to be taken into consideration. Kind of the scare tactics and everything else that go along with this debate, when you sit around and talk about this and finally pull it apart, I think what you have before you is an excellent product. And I think it's the testimony to it is the variety of people who are sitting at the table saying thumbs up at the same time. Most of them don't even like me, so it's...
I noticed they were moving over a little bit when you were talking about. Yeah. All right.
With that, Well, any questions at the end?
Right. Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and hear from everyone else, and we'll see if there's any questions.
Very good. Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Bill Gardner. I'm the general manager for International Paper's craft paper bag business. We've got a plant in Beaverton, and we've got over 300 employees working at the complexes in Beaverton. In Oregon, we have 900 employees working at 12 different locations, and we have annual sales around $350 million worth of products made in Oregon. Paper industry has been kind of brought into the discussion by the, I guess, the defense of the plastic industry. We hadn't been involved in the discussion until recently in California and now in Oregon. But with the defense of the plastic bags, we've kind of been pulled in. So to give you some background, paper bags have been around for over 150 years. Plastic bags have entered the market over the last 30 years, and those environmental impacts that have occurred over the last 30 years have brought the discussion about the environmental impacts of plastic bags. There are some, you know, some commonly known advantages of paper bags. First, obviously, is the litter and its impact on wildlife. You know, if paper bags end up as litter, they naturally decompose. Plastic bags, on the other hand, stay around for possibly hundreds of years, getting into the waterways and harming the wildlife. Second, or the third on your list of the commonly known advantages is the fact that paper bags are made from renewable resources as opposed to plastic being made from finite, unrenewable resources. And finally, the other commonly known advantage is paper recycling rate. Paper recycling is an environmental success story. Paper packaging recycling in the U.S. has reached 66% of all paper packaging used in the U.S. is recovered and recycled. So that's five times higher than plastic. And because of the economics involved, paper recycling continues to accelerate to higher and higher levels because it's very economical to reuse paper over and over again. About 3 years ago in 2007, the plastic bags industry did a what they call a life cycle analysis to compare a paper and a plastic bag. There were three erroneous assumptions in that study. When you look at that study, they assumed three things. Well, first, they assumed that no plastic bags end up as litter as part of the life cycle analysis study. They assumed that when each paper bag is replaced at a grocery store, it only takes one plastic bag, maybe one and a half plastic bags, and it's commonly perceived that it's more like 3-to-1. And then they assumed that paper bags were only recycled at a rate of 21%, and if you look at the EPA data, you know it's somewhere between 38 and 66%, just because you can put the bookends on it. So when you reverse those three assumptions, it reverses virtually all the conclusions of the scientific study. So up until the point of disposal, paper bags actually generate 59% fewer greenhouse gases than plastic bags. Less water pollution, obviously, when you don't take into account the fact that plastic bags are the main water pollution issue, paper bags have a distinct advantage on water pollution. And then fossil fuel use, correcting the assumptions, paper bags consume 33% less fossil fuel, and because paper mills are using more and more renewable energy, that advantage for paper is only increasing. After disposal, you know, the end-of-life story for a paper bag is an extremely positive one when you come to recycling, biodegradability, use for composting, all the good things at the end of life of a paper bag. The argument from plastic could be that because plastic bags never biodegrade, they don't give off any greenhouse gases at the end of life. You could see that as a positive, but you could also see that as a negative. The good news is a paper bag, even though it biodegrades, when we keep it out of the landfill, a biodegradable product, paper bags, actually generate less greenhouse gas over the entire life cycle than a product that doesn't biodegrade. All we've got to do is keep it out of the landfill. And the big issue is if a paper bag goes into a landfill and it decomposes without oxygen, it produces methane, and that production of methane is a potent greenhouse gas. So with the recycling rate reaching 66%, and continuing to go that way, the advantage is going to be a distinct advantage for paper bags over the entire life cycle. And that's pretty significant when you've got a product that biodegrades and can have a greenhouse gas advantage. So in closing, our employees in Beaverton and across Oregon are very proud of our environmentally friendly products. We believe that the distinct advantage for the end of life for a paper bag makes it the best choice. Paper bags can be reused over and over again. They fold up really nicely in the back of your car. And at the end of life, it's got a great story. It doesn't end up as something that's going to hurt the environment. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Murray. I'm Vice President of Business Development for Far West Fibers, a privately held recycling company in Oregon. Far West operates three major recycling facilities in the metro area, one in Northeast Portland, one in Beaverton, right down the street from International Paper, and one in Hillsboro. I'm here today in support of the legislation being proposed to ban the use of plastic bags. Today I'm specifically here to address the challenges plastic bags create on our recycling system and the damage it does to our recycling system. We do recognize that there is greater environmental damage that other people have been talking about, but we have our own specific issue within our own industry. I have the permission of my competitors to speak in regards to this issue on their behalf, and we all agree that plastic bags and other film plastics are the single biggest challenge for us properly sorting the recyclables that you set out at the curb. The reason why the bags are such an issue for us is we use a series of types of screens and also people to sort the material. And these screens are made up of basically different sized discs that are various distances apart from one another. And what happens with the plastic bag is there's little fingers on these discs. The bags wrap onto these fingers, and over time more and more build up, and our system ends up failing. We're not able to get the various types of materials apart from one another because of that. We have to put more labor on the sort line. Every break that our employees have, 4 to 8 people at each facility, and like I said, every break, have to climb into these systems, into these screens, and actually cut these bags out. And it's an incredible volume of material. The most injuries we have, though they're not major, but the majority of injuries that we have in our facilities are related to this having to climb into the system, into the screens, and cut out these bags. We estimate that 25 to 30% of our sort labor is related to dealing with these plastic bags, whether it's actually pulling them out by hand or cutting them out of the screens. During the coming session, I will offer to show an updated version of the slideshow I showed last year to show you specifically what's entailed when we have to deal with these bags. Also, on Wednesday, January 26th, Association Oregon Recyclers will, for the second time, discuss the problems with plastic bags and whether we should be supporting a bag ban. Also, I want to recognize that IP, originally Weyerhaeuser in this market, originally Willamette Industries for us, was the original funding source for Far West Fibers. We have long-term agreements with IP, and virtually all of our brown fiber, with some exception, goes to their Springfield mill for reprocessing. Thank you.
Questions for the panel?
Madam Chair, I just think it's just very significant that you have these three representatives of business here that pretty much are, I think, emblematic of the problem that's out there. In addition to this being an environmental problem, you have your grocers and the paper industry and, of course, the recyclers. And, I'm kind of struck by this panel, and I don't mean to gush about it, but I do appreciate Bill Gardner's comments about trying to dispel this myth that somehow plastic bags are more environmentally friendly, and I appreciate that. We'll try to continue to dispel that myth.
Senator Boquist?
I'm not going to let him off so easy, so.
it's your last time.
That's
so,
exactly
you know,
right.
You missed my introduction.
Actually, I listened to the to the deal I was getting so here.
Okay.
So I'm ahead of the power curve there. In reading through the bill, and I think everybody in this room knows, especially the environmental side, I'm not that far off from my two colleagues to my left over there or your right, but I do have some questions and concerns. I mean, the grocers, can you walk through how this works? Because we have this exception, that exception. In the nutshell, it looks like, you know, you get charged 5 cents for a paper bag. You've kind of answered my question by saying 66% of the bags are recycled, so the 40% mark is not a real big deal here. But in practicality, from a grocer standpoint, in my district, and I'm not talking Safeway or those people, I'm talking about the small guys, how would this work?
Person comes into the store, and there's no longer a free bag, if you will. People think it's a free bag. They're paying for it in the price of their groceries. Is no longer available. They can use a reusable bag. They can use anything they bring in, or they can buy a reusable bag. What this bill does, though, it provides a alternative for all of us who forget that that the grocer is not forced to, but is allowed to sell a paper bag at a minimum of 5 cents. So every retailer is on the same level playing field, that no one's giving them away or drawing customers in by saying we have free bags. And it also leaves that basis of, I keep forgetting, I'm not going to get pounded only for a nickel a bag, but it's not going to cost me $1 or $2 each time I go in. But there is an alternative, and my attention is brought to it. That bag has to be 40% recycled. It can't be a bag that's less than that. And we want to make sure that that bag is environmentally friendly and something that's being used over and over. But that's the big change for the consumer. If you come in and forget, it may cost you a nickel bag to get out of the store with your stuff. You don't have to do that. You can avoid it. You can bring your own bags. You can change your habits. You can do all that. The plastic is gone, though. So in no circumstance is there a T-shirt bag. It's really what we're talking about here. Now, beyond the point of sale, so at the cash register, Senator Boquist, there's nothing. Most of the exemptions you see in there that are written in there are they exempt the other bags in the store. So your produce bag that's plastic is not going to be affected by this. You're not going to be banned. You're not going to get a charge. Because those are more a food safety issue. You're separating your produce from your meat. You're wrapping those things so you don't have those things touching each other when they go into your bag. Your pharmacy bags are exempt. There's federal issues there. Privacy issues, and so we're not going to mess with the pharmacy bags. You get into a whole big problem with federal issues. And the last piece you have to address is both WIC customers, women and infant children, and the SNAP benefits, because there are guidelines on how we have to treat them. So those were put in there just to comply with federal law.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And the bill says charge not less than 5 cents for each recycled bag. So 5 cents is the bottom floor. There is no top. Is that how I'm reading this?
Chair Dingfeld, Senator Boquist, that is correct. 5 cents will basically reimburse the cost of the paper bag. Paper bag runs anywhere 4 to 6 cents. If you add handles, it goes bigger than that if someone wants to do that. There's no prescription other than that bag has to be 40% recycled, and that's about the price of that bag. So the retailer's made whole for the bag, but it's not a profit center or something like that.
The last quote, yeah, sure. Flipping, not getting you guys off here, too. Cost of a paper bag, I mean, I buy boxes and so on and so forth, but what's the average retail for a decent quality, recyclable paper bag with a handle?
That's about the right. You can go to Costco.com or Sam'sClub.com, and you'll find, a handle bag for somewhere between 5 and 7 cents.
Last question, Madam Chair. And energy costs related to paper production and recycling? I mean, you said it's less expensive to use paper long-term, which is great in my district because we don't cut enough trees.
It's less expensive. Say that again.
You're saying it's less expensive to use paper and recycle it than it is to use plastic bags long-term is kind of what you were alluding to. But what's the energy cost in paper versus plastic production in a life cycle?
I guess I'm trying to make sure I understand the question before
I'll rephrase it. The paper bag lasts X amount after you recycle it. So you have a life cycle of a paper bag that's recyclable over time. The flip side, like you said, you've done a cost analysis, is it takes X number of plastic bags to make up the difference if you weren't using the paper recyclable bag. And you said it's less expensive for paper over the long term than it is for plastic.
Okay, I'll make sure I
clarify
my comments.
You can follow up later, too, if you want.
But I'll be glad to. what I said was that it takes two or three plastic bags to carry the same amount as a paper bag, and when you get that ratio wrong, you can cut your environmental impacts in half by saying it takes fewer plastic bags than paper bags to carry the same amount of groceries, so it allows you to change the outcome of a life cycle analysis. So when you correct that ratio, the total fossil fuel energy used to make paper bags is 33% less when you correct the ratio of the number of plastic bags it takes to carry the groceries home.
And could we get a copy of that study at some future point?
Yes.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Gardner?
Yeah. I'm trying to place your accent. Are you from, say, Lincoln City?
I'm afraid I have the absence of an accent. I've lived in Atlanta, London, Houston, Memphis, Pennsylvania.
There you go.
So where's it from?
I get a little bit of
there is no southern accent.
Yeah.
You didn't have to listen to Dave.
I was going to say that the right answer is you have an Oregon accent now, right?
It depends on how many Guinnesses he drank over
there. Right. All right, thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll look forward to hearing from you again next session, I'm sure. And our last couple of witnesses, and we'll ask you if you can wrap up briefly, please, because we are running a little bit over, is Kim Smith, the director of the Oregon Zoo, and Brock Hell. I think Brock's here, isn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, Ms. Smith, if you want to get started.
Sure.
Great.
Chair Dinkelfelder and members of the committee. My name is Kim Smith. I'm the director of the Oregon Zoo, and it's a privilege to be here today. As you know, I oversee the largest paid tourist attraction in the state, which is the Oregon Zoo. We receive 1.7 million visitors every day, and we are very committed to sustainability and environmental leadership, and our mission is to inspire our community to create a better future for wildlife. And one of the things at our zoo, we actually don't use plastic bags at all in our zoo. We don't use them in the gift shop. We don't use them anywhere in the zoo. We actually don't even use paper cups and things that aren't recyclable. And one of the things that's really, really important, all the testimony we've heard today, we support all of it, and many of the members have said a lot of the things that are in my written testimony for you. But one of the things, if you think about with plastic bags, is we have an incredible ocean that borders our state. And there are two Texas-sized islands of plastic debris in the Pacific Ocean near Midway Island. And plastic bags are a huge portion of that. It affects wildlife and their health. Wildlife eats those pieces of plastic. If you look at some of the pictures you see around Midway Island, you've got things like Stiller sea lions that eat that plastic. You've got birds that feed it to their young. And so one of the biggest missions of the zoo is obviously conserving wildlife. And to watch these animals eat these items and interact with them, it's a sure death. This is not something they come out of alive. Plastics are not biodegradable in their systems. They can drown if they interact with plastic bags in the ocean. There was a study done in France that showed offshore that 90% of the debris was plastic bags offshore of the urban areas. If you think about the amount of plastic coming off of our urban areas going into the ocean, and that 90% of that near the offshore area could be plastic bags that then floats into our wildlife and into other areas like the Midway Island, Texas-sized islands, it's pretty horrific, and it's a huge impact on our wildlife. So it's a privilege to be here today to testify on this. We are very passionate about it. We support it. And it's something that we feel is critically important to the future of our wildlife and the environment.
Right. Thank you. Brock, and we have your written testimony, so if you can summarize.
It will be brief. Yeah, I'm not going to say the whole thing. Thank you, Chair Dinkelfelder and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell. I'm the State Policy Advocate for Environment Oregon. We're a state-based and funded environmental group with over 50,000 members and supporters statewide. Since March, we have talked to over 150,000 Oregonians who have overwhelmingly supported a statewide ban on plastic checkout bags. There is about 100 million tons of plastic trash in the North Pacific Ocean concentrated by the ocean's currents into an area that's about twice the size of Texas, where plastic is 43 times more prevalent than plankton, the fundamental food source of our ocean. It kills millions of sea turtles, birds, whales, fish, and other marine wildlife every year, which is why we've been working so hard to make sure that we get rid of plastic checkout bags, which represent about 1.7. Oregonians use about 1.7 billion plastic bags each year. It's the number one source of our beach litter in Oregon, and so we can make a meaningful difference for the ocean by banning the single-use item. One of the things you'll notice from my testimony is we do have 300 or more than 300 businesses that support the campaign, as well as over 50 environmental groups and community groups. In addition, the cities of Lake Oswego, Newport, and Portland have passed resolutions in support of a statewide ban, and we expect other cities to come on as well. But what we would really like, as opposed to a hodgepodge approach where there's different regulations in different cities, is one uniform state law on this issue. And so with that, I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you both. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to hearing back from you again next session. Would you like to make any other comments before we move on to the next issue?
No, I just do appreciate the people coming together. We've had lots of meetings this past year on this, and we'll continue. And I think it was noted somewhere, but I think we've got like 8 or 9 local city governments have passed resolutions urging the legislature to pass this resolution, much to the relief of some of the retailers who don't want to deal with one law in Portland, a different one in Corvallis, and no law in Eugene, and so on, and coming together for this a state solution.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you all who came here to testify today, and again, we'll look forward to hearing more from you next session. So with that, we will move on to the next issue on our agenda. We have, as you see, a full agenda. I'll let people leave here for a minute. The next two issues, can you stay for a second, are very important because these are committee bills that we'll be having a work session on later this morning, and these are the only two committee bills that we'll be introducing, so we're going to have the background information on that. Before we do that, though, since we have two members of my committee that are no longer going to be with us, and I know they can't stay for the whole time, I want to especially thank my vice chair, who has served for how many years? Since 1998, working on natural resource issues. He's going to be sorely missed, although he won't be too far away. I think you'll be probably coming in front of the committee testifying on some bills, but it's been an honor and a pleasure to work
with
you. And same to my colleague at the end of the dais, who I've sat next to in Judiciary, which I heard he's not going to be on that committee, and he's now going on to, as I mentioned before, greener pastures for chairing his own committee, but... We're also going to miss your expertise and interest in these issues, and so just wanted to thank both of you. It's been an honor and a pleasure to serve with you, and we'll look forward to working with you on issues throughout next session. But I would be remiss if I didn't have something that I would share.
Thank you very much.
Endangered species chocolate. Bears for Senator Boquist and
this
wolves
for
Senator Atkinson.
So thank you.
Thought you'd appreciate that and would think of us as you're enjoying the endangered species chocolate issues you both worked on, I know, with passion. So
I would have thought it had been wolf chocolate, not bear chocolate.
Yeah, it was a toss-up, but, you know, I know that you worked on the bears and cougar issue when we were in the House together. So anyway.
Thank you very much.
And I know we'll be hearing more from you, although you won't be on this committee. I have a feeling you'll be involved with natural resource issues next session anyway, but you will be sorely missed. Anyway, with that, we will move back to the issue at hand, our committee bills. Both of them, I think, very important bills. First one, ballot measure 76 implementation. I'm actually going to ask Beth if you can say a few words of introduction before we have the panel. And many of you, of course, know that we had a ballot measure, measure 76, that passed overwhelmingly by the voters of Oregon. And what you see before you is the implementing language for that ballot measure. Beth's going to do a brief introduction, and then we have some panelists that are going to talk more about the specifics.
In front of you in your packets, you should have a copy of LC-2001. This is a first draft of a bill that would implement the ballot measure. There are some issues still to be addressed in this LC, including the setup of the funds and some other technical issues that are going to have to be fixed, but it is a start. I guess the one other thing I would note that is not in here right now but could be added to the bill is language that would implement the parks side of the ballot measure.
Okay, and I've asked the panelists that are here today that have been working very closely with my committee staff to make sure that we're on the right track for implementing this ballot measure. It's a very important ballot measure. I don't know if you want to provide a little bit of background on the history, just for the record. I think that would be helpful. And I'm going to ask Bruce Taylor from Defenders of Wildlife to start off the testimony. Thank you,
Chair Dingfelder. My name is Bruce Taylor, and I work for Defenders of Wildlife, but I'm here today representing the broader coalition of groups and organizations that were behind the ballot measure 76, and that's the Water, Parks, and Wildlife Coalition. But I'm also joined here today by two of my colleagues, Jan Lee of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts and Tom O'Brien with the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils, two of the major traditional stakeholders for this program here. And thank you for noting, Chair Dingfelder, yes, overwhelmingly passed by the voters, 69% margin of more than 500,000 votes, and more important, I think, for all of us, majorities, solid majorities in every county across Oregon. The ballot measure itself at its heart really just continued the current allocation of 15% of the state's lottery receipts to parks and natural resources. But the measure did include some provisions updating the constitutional language to reflect the program's evolution over the last 12 years or so. And it's those changes there that trigger the need for some changes in the statute, which will be the task for the 2011 legislature. So to help set the stage for that process, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to lay out what we were trying to do with Measure 76, some of our thinking, and what that means for the implementing legislation that we've been working with Senator Dingfelder and the committee staff on. We really wanted to build on all the success of the last 12 years. The original ballot measure 66 back in 1998, really jump-started a an investment program, a conservation investment program, the likes of which Oregon has never seen. And it really helped create a national model here in Oregon for how conservation can be done at the local level through voluntary, cooperative, collaborative partnership approaches rather than strictly the command and control regulatory approaches. So we wanted to maintain that the fundamental precepts and vision behind that approach there while updating the ballot measure, the constitutional language, and creating a framework that could more easily adapt in the future as the legislature and the state face changing needs and priorities. So we already have in place the most important things we need for this program here. We have plans, the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, the Oregon Conservation Strategy that tell us what's important to do, where to do that. We have a good local delivery infrastructure in place in the watershed councils and the soil and water districts and other local community-based organizations out there. And we have a grants program administered by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that has a lot of experience in actually getting that money out on the ground into projects that produce results. So with the ballot measure, we just wanted to update the policy priorities that would guide the conservation investments. We wanted to strengthen and maintain the local delivery infrastructure that we already have in place. And we wanted to try to maximize the amount of money that actually gets out there on the ground in the streams for real conservation out in the real world. Looking at the policy framework there, we recognized that we were talking not just something that had a sunset or limited lifespan anymore, but this was a long-term program and we needed to be careful about how we set it up. So we chose to focus in the constitutional language there not on who should be getting the money, but what the purposes were and what the outcomes were for those lottery funds. Recognizing that the specifics would change over time, the state's priorities would change over time, who's best positioned to do the work will change over time, but that the basic principles could remain the same. So because we already have a solid program in place, I think the legislation that it's taken will be required to implement the ballot measure is fairly straightforward. Our coalition's been meeting for several months now, 4 or 5 months now, and talking with the staff of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and back and forth with Senator Dingfelder and Beth Petrino in trying to put together the concepts behind the legislation that's in the draft before you there this morning. And although I should say that we started with much grander ambitions when the ballot measure 76 programs are embedded in the statutes with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and the Oregon Plan, all of which have been cobbled together over the years and is really kind of a mess, but straightening that out proves to be a more complex task than we were up to or thought that you would all be up to in 2011, given all the other things on your agenda. So we have chosen to focus on a more minimalist approach, the bare minimum necessary to actually implement the ballot measure and make sure this thing will work. So most of the changes that you will see in the legislation there are technical in nature. The biggest constitutional change deals with the allocation of the natural resource funds. The park side, there are some changes, and we're not really talking about them today. They're a little bit more straightforward. But on the natural resources side, it's always been split into two pots. 65% was reserved for capital expenditures, acquisition of lands and water rights, and on-the-ground restoration, long-term investments. And the other 35% was available for non-capital costs of the state's watershed health and habitat conservation programs. Measure 76 retained that basic 65-35 split, but it directs the 65% now into the Conservation Grants Program, currently administered by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and leaves the 35% available for the legislature to allocate for a specific set of purposes, including the local infrastructure for delivery of the program, the watershed councils, soil and water districts, and maintaining the state's strategies, making sure that we're actually have the strategies and plans in place to put those investments in the right places. So we think that the elimination of the capital, non-capital distinction will allow OWEB in particular to take a more holistic approach to grant making. It's no longer this capital. They always had a lot of capital funds and no non-capital, which could often mean you could get money to build a project, but no money to do the engineering to design it. So that will make life easier for OWEB and for people out on the ground trying to do that work. It also keeps it very clear in the statutes that the grants program is supposed to remain focused on the purposes in the Constitution, but gives the legislature more flexibility in adapting how that program gets delivered over time in the future. The other significant changes in Measure 76 relate to the updated purposes and priorities, which I've appended at the end of the statement there. Basically maintains the current focus of the program, puts a little finer point on this is about watershed health and water quality and habitat conservation for native fish and wildlife, but essentially keep things in much the same direction. And that concludes my summary here, and unless there are any immediate questions, I would just pass it over to my colleagues here.
Okay. Jan? Yes, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, my name is Jan Lee, and I'm the president-elect of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts and the chair of the Clackamas Soil and Water District. Our organization represents the 46 SWCDs around the state. We're local governments, and we provide technical assistance on a voluntary basis to both urban and rural landowners. For us, this funding, this program is extremely critical, both for districts and for watershed councils, so that we can place this money on the ground in projects and leverage it with other dollars from federal governments and local entities. During the last biennium, 7 through 9, as conservation districts, we were able to get $8.8 million on the ground, and since 1999, it's been $44.6 million. The written testimony I provided you goes into more detail about projects and what has occurred.
But what's really important about ballot measure 76 and our communities is that many of our communities are rural. We need jobs. We're finding that with ballot measure 66, we were able to support some of the small businesses in the community through contracting and through purchasing supplies, so that every dollar that comes out of this program and goes to the ground generates five more in the community. And that's really the important point about this, in addition to the environmental changes that have been able to occur. So we strongly support this bill as a part of the coalition, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder. My name is Tom O'Brien, and I'm the Executive Director of the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils, and my accent is becoming Oregonian. Having moved here just a little over a year ago, I've been immersed in working closely with the Conservation Coalition. In my days off, as it were, it was the third leading signature gatherer in Oregon. And I just state that to express our dedication and commitment to the work that we're doing here together. So watershed councils are community-based organizations enabled by statute and recognized locally by county governments. And they're designed to achieve a three-part mission, what we call the triple bottom line, to try to restore the health of watersheds, improve local economies, and to help build communities. There are approximately 95 councils, about two-thirds of which receive direct support funding from OWEB. And a study commissioned out of, not commissioned, but generated out of University of Oregon a year ago, demonstrated that for every $1 million of restoration investments, a little over 16 jobs are generated at the local level. So why councils? They, along with soil and water conservation districts, are the primary means by which the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is implemented. Councils and districts complement each other at the local level. They expand the scope of work between themselves and the number and kinds of people involved, often enlarging the size of the economic pie, principally because councils can attract dollars as nonprofit organizations that local public agencies may not. Their primary goal is to work with landowners on private lands on a voluntary basis. And that is complementary to what the government agencies typically can achieve. So the monies are well spent. Councils and districts in most places work very well together, and in many cases share resources and deliver complementary services. They also, councils help to transcend political boundaries. Conservation issues often do. And councils are in a position to do so, not being restricted by those political boundaries. In closing, I'd like to say that we consider watershed councils an essential part of Oregon's restoration economy. They empower Oregonians in every community, and they help bridge us to a society of future healthy watersheds, strong local economies, and viable local communities. Thank you for this opportunity this morning to speak with you. And I'm going to just step back in order to give Tom Byler a place at the table as well.
Okay. All right. I think there may be some questions, Senator Atkinson.
Several. Thank you. I was an outspoken supporter of Measure 76. So I say that, and I say that I've got some major concerns with the language, so my questions are directed not at the panel necessarily, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. broadly. Where's the word park in here?
Senator Atkinson, there is a section in here that deals with the parks issues, but we did not yet have the changes that are necessary in that section included in this draft, which was an oversight. But it needs to be updated to reflect the new ballot measure language.
Okay. So that'll be an amendment to this.
Okay. Second issue. We, through getting Measure 76 passed and streamlining it, are not solving the major problem we had with the original bill, which was we had two silos of funding. And those two silos of funding, getting money on the ground, was impossible. And it was partisan. And it was urban versus rural. And all those other horrible things that we say we don't want is what it was. And this bill the implementation of 76 is supposed to get projects on the ground that restore the Klamath, the Rogue, the Illinois, the Applegate, and a whole bunch of rivers and a whole bunch of areas that are not necessarily represented in what I'm seeing here. What I'm seeing here is that the Watershed Enhancement Board is, we're changing the language, which I'm fine with, but they're going to be picking winners and losers based on either the Oregon plan or the conservation strategy, not on parks. And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but this seems to me to not solve the problem of getting projects and money on the ground.
Okay.
Am I missing that?
Well, I think, Senator, in the absence of the language that updates the park statutes, it's difficult to see what's in the LC draft. What you're looking at, is, for example, on the bottom of page 1, deals with half of the grant. Half of the fund that the ballot measure sets up. So there's a fund that the entire 7% of the lottery dollars goes into. That large fund is then divided into two. The parks fund is half of it. The natural resources fund is the other half of it. And then the half that's the natural resources fund is then divided again, 65% for grants, 35% for other programs that address watershed health issues. So the divisions are not easy to see in the LC.
Thank you. What I'm concerned about is that the divisions turn into a management headache and don't actually get the projects on the ground.
Well, I think what I'm going to do is ask Tom Beiler to come up. If you could address his comments, that would be helpful. I don't know if you wanted to add anything, but I want to make sure we get these addressed.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson. I would agree with Beth Petrino's responses. We're not seeing the whole picture yet with the draft that you have before you. With respect to not getting the dollars on the ground, I may have a slightly different perspective on that. I think that we have a pretty good system for getting dollars on the ground. One of the challenges we have is that the demand exceeds our ability to fund all the projects that are out there. We've got a lot of really productive councils and districts and other local partners who are developing good projects. We're not able to fund them all. And so my hope is that we can continue to do the best we can to meet those demands over time.
Can I interrupt you? I'm going to interrupt you. And let me give you a case in point. 8 years to create the mall into a state park. 8 years took me. And the biggest problem I had was, well, we can't dip into fish funds because that's a park. Yada, 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 you can't touch the lottery funds, we need to go to a committee. 8 years. Now that it's done, everybody says, boy, God, why wasn't that done earlier? So, tell me that process is going to improve. That was a bureaucratic nightmare.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson.
With all due respect. I mean, I say that lovingly in the Christmas cheer.
Is this where we go, ho, ho, ho?
Yeah.
I'm going to pick up the grid.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, I think that the Measure 76 attempts to give some clarity around the different pots of funding that under this broad authority. But I certainly understand that people are going to have different perspectives on what it means. And I think that we'll have some conversations, I expect, with the new session about not only the implementation statutes, but on how those funds, where those funds should be distributed.
Well, here's what I hope would happen. I hope on the implementation that this would be used as a confidence builder outside of Multnomah County. I'm somebody that doesn't particularly subscribe to urban-rural divide. That's not what I'm talking about. But a confidence building in the terms of all the people who supported this measure in Klamath County and Lake County and places where these dollars don't get would say, hey, you know, when they see the very expensive television commercials from the lottery that says lottery doing great things for Oregon, right? We don't believe it necessarily. So it would be very good if we can make sure somehow, either in the language or in our checklist of protocol, that those dollars get quickly on the ground to either water enhancement, you know, or watershed, either in rural Oregon, in eastern Oregon, because we don't. It's very hard for us to see. We actually see parks that get closed. We see counties that start to say, we can no longer maintain our parks. We have major issues with regards to maintaining river put-ins and river access and all those issues that this could be used to actually get more Oregonians outside protecting the environment. I mean, so I'm clearly not picking winners and losers between fish and parks. I mean, clearly I go to a park to catch fish. So, I mean, you know, I'm just saying that I think there's a – I want to make sure that if as we're going forward, because what we're going to do here is going to outlive all of us. I just want to make sure that we learn those lessons between those silos and those little fiefdoms that we had that actually didn't get the work done. We solve it in this enabling language.
Just very quickly, Senator Atkinson, on the park side, and I think you're talking about the local share grants going to local parks, and in the past there was not a fixed percentage in the program for how much would go to the local parks grant side, local and regional parks, and the ballot measure set a minimum of 12%, which has been the historic average. And I think one of the issues for the local park providers was it went up and down. Some years there was very little funds available for local parks grants, and other years there were more, but there was no predictability. So ballot measure 76 at least provides a floor for the local parks grants program.
And Beth, that'll be in the next,
yes.
that'll in the enabling language that we don't see?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, I apologize, we just couldn't get that portion turned around by LC fast enough, and we will make sure with a hearing next session that we also have the parks director here. I think it's really important, sitting on the Ways and Means Natural Resources subcommittee, we've had a lot of discussion about this, and especially about the local share. I do think, though, the demand still outweighs what we actually, even with this new ballot measure. Mm-hmm. Because I hear the same thing from inside Multnomah County that you're hearing outside Multnomah County, that not enough money is going to projects within, you know, my district and my county, and the bottom line is that there's way more need than there is the ability to fund it. So I think overall, though, we need to make sure that the language is very clear. So we'll continue to work with you all, Senator.
Yeah.
And I think Senator Boquist had a question, too.
Mr. Taylor, I just want to go back to your testimony. In there, you stated on the record, and it says, under the scope of proposed legislation, although many of us started this process with far grander ambitions, the bill is expected to be basically limited to these changes on the existing statutes. Can you kind of give us the preview of what are the grander ambitions that aren't going to be in the bill?
As a citizen who actually read through the statutes, I found it very hard to understand what state law actually intended for these programs.
Shocking,
so my personal ambition was that maybe we could rewrite the statutes so everybody had a more clear understanding of what the programs were and how they were intended to run. And it is like a big bowl of spaghetti there, and once you start pulling one little piece out, this is your draft is 21 pages, and I think it would be 121 pages. And if you all would like to spend the time talking about those issues, I think it would be wonderful. It may not be opportune for this legislature, though.
Okay, I was going to say, welcome to our world, whether it's a bowl
yes.
of spaghetti or making sausage.
There's a fair amount of internal inconsistency there.
All right. Senator Boquist.
Well, you know, sausage only comes in one link. Spaghetti goes all over the place, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'm this draft as is, you know, I'm not as adamant as my colleague across the way, but I think, as you know, and I'm going to restate what I've probably said a dozen times, my beef is on the park side. And the last time we did this, when it was passed on two words from the voters, and this time it was passed on two words from the voters, and that's parks and fish. And whether I like it or not, we're doing okay on the fish side and we're making progress on there. But the park side, the last time around, the state of Oregon and this legislature allowed the state agency to develop a 13-year plan to reduce the deferred maintenance mm-hmm. on our parks. And people aren't interested in going to the park 3 years from now after it's been maintained or restored, will we go out and buy six new ones? And we need to, from the park side, reconsolidate, reorganize, stop talking about new everything else, go back and repair, restore, and do the environmental maintenance we need to do on our existing parks that we have, not develop another 13-year plan that says, oh, we're going to close this one this year, and 6 years from now we're going to use money to go back and reopen it. And that has been an absolute failure from the citizens' point of view. It's great to go out, and there's always going to be the opportunity to get new land, get new parks, but we have got, in this economic time, address the issue of how are we going to maintain what we have and not a 13-year plan like was approved long before any of us, I think, were in the legislature 13 years ago.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. And like I said, we will make sure we have parks here. We have had a lot of discussion in the Ways and Means Subcommittee about parks maintenance, so I appreciate you bringing that up. And we'll make sure that Tim Woods or whoever the park director is next year, we don't know who all the directors will be, but certainly we'll make sure that parks is here. You will see another draft once we have that new language, so rest assured. So, and I don't know, Tom, if you would like to comment at all.
Well, thank you, Chair Dingfelder. You do have written
closing
testimony
comments
from OWEB. I'm not going to go into that, but I just want to make a couple of summary remarks to emphasize some points that you heard from the other panelists today, and that is that as an interested bystander watching the Measure 76 campaign, we were thrilled to see the result, because we think in part it's a validation of the work that OWEB is helping support in local communities around the state. And watershed conservation restoration grants are a great way. It's not just what it does, but it's how we're doing it that is really making a difference and makes it a unique program in the state of Oregon. We're empowering local communities on a voluntary basis to work with private landowners to solve often very complex natural resources issues in their own watersheds. And we're seeing over time that not only is this a great formula for success, and it builds community around problem solving, but it also pours necessary and well-received resources into local economies. And it's a great combination. It's a great formula. It's working well. And we feel that as we look at Measure 76, from an OWEB standpoint, we see this as a maintaining the essential components and purposes and structure that we have currently with respect to the delivery of restoration work around the state. So we stand ready and willing and able to work together with you going into the new session to put the implementing legislation together.
Great. Thank you. And committee members, I know that a couple of you won't be here, but hopefully you'll still be tracking this issue. We will be pulling together sort of an informal work group once we have our next draft to make sure that we have all the stakeholders at the table getting the necessary language that we need. This is a very important task that we have ahead of us, committee members. I mean, this is the voters have spoken, overwhelmingly support this. We need to make sure that we get it right in implementing this language so we can ensure to continue to get those dollars on the ground and ensure that our parks are sustainable. So I think we have our work cut out for us, but I'm optimistic and hopeful with many of the folks in the room that we'll be able to get it right, and you'll be seeing another draft, my sense is, hopefully, next few weeks, and then we'll continue working on it until we have hearings again in February. All right. Thank you very much.
Ho, ho, ho.
Thank you.
Okay. Sure you don't want to stay on and help on work on that?
I'll still work on that.
Yeah.
No.
Well, we appreciate that. Yeah. So, as
right.
Exactly. Okay, next up we have the other committee bill, or committee concept, I should say, LC 2750. And we heard testimony on this proposed legislation last time, and this is prohibits the sale or offering of brake friction material that mainly contains some heavy metals. Going to hear from some of the industry today. Last time we heard from the science components and ecological components were of concern. We heard from Marine Fisheries Service, and we heard from else do we hear from us?
Folks in Washington and California.
Yeah, folks in Washington and California. If you recall, committee members, this is legislation that has already passed in the states of California and Washington. We've looked very carefully at both those state legislative concepts. We've been talking to both the states of California and Washington about the implementation of these bills. And so, once again, the concept that you see in front of you is not final. We're still working on the final language. Beth, if you want to say a few words about that before we call up the panel.
Committee members, that you have in front of you LC 2750. There is also a brief summary and a memo from me which lays out the components of the bill. The main factors are the application of criteria that would limit certain elements and fibers and brake pads by January 1st, 2014, and then add copper to that list of elements January 1st, 2021. There are differences between the Washington and California bills that passed. What this draft does is ask Department of Environmental Quality to watch the process that's going on in Washington, where they are going to be evaluating alternative brake friction materials. And at the time that process concludes that those materials are available, DEQ would then make a report to this legislature on its recommendations for possibly lowering the level of copper in brake pad materials. Okay. And that's essentially what the bill does.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And one thing I want to emphasize is that obviously the states are taking the lead on this. It's not happening at the federal level right now. So I have been very cognizant of the fact that we want to make sure and have consistency. One of the reasons that bringing this bill forward is so that we do have consistent legislation on the West Coast. And I think, once again, the West Coast will be a leader for the nation on this issue. And looking forward to, have been working very closely with the manufacturing industry, and we're going to hear today from several members of the automobile manufacturing industry. So we have four people that would like to come up and testify. I'm not sure if all of them are here, but I will call you up. Nelson Garcia is the Director of Federal State Policy with the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association. Paul Cosgrove is representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Is Daryl Fuller here, Daryl? And actually, Tom, I don't know if you can also pull up a chair. It might be good just to have everybody up there. Daryl Fuller is representing Northwest Auto Trades Association, and Tom Gallagher is representing the Automobile Dealers Association. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. Why don't we start out with Mr. Garcia?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nelson Garcia, Director of Federal and State Policy for the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association in Washington, D.C. I would like to first of all thank you for holding this important informational hearing. I would also like to express MEMA's sincere appreciation to your staff for reaching out to our industry to further discuss our views and concerns regarding the reduction of copper in brake pads. The Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association, or MEMA, represents over 600 companies that manufacture motor vehicle parts for use in the light vehicle and heavy-duty original equipment and aftermarket industries. Motor vehicle parts suppliers are the nation's largest manufacturing sector, directly employing over 685,000 U.S. workers and contributing to over 3.2 million jobs across the country. MEMA has been active in the collaborative efforts among the stakeholders to reduce copper in brake pads. These efforts have created a fair and balanced approach that simultaneously addresses the environmental needs of the state while protecting the economic viability of the industry. With the passage of copper mitigation legislation in California and Washington State, MEMA believes that the need for additional legislation at this time in other states is no longer necessary. As a result of the California and Washington laws, the industry will be required to meet strict deadlines to eliminate copper and brake friction materials, which will impact all 50 states. Both laws prohibit five specific minerals from being sold in both states by 2014. By 2021, no brake friction material can be sold in both states that contain more than 5% copper and its compounds by weight. By 2025, California bans brake friction material that exceeds 0.5% copper by weight from being sold in the state. Washington, on the other hand, also bans the sale of brake friction material exceeding 0.5% copper by weight once a proven and safe alternative replacement material is identified. The resulting benefits of phasing out copper by 2025 will impact all friction materials sold across the United States. For business efficiency and cost effectiveness, the industry as a whole will reformulate brake friction materials that are free of copper, not just for the state of California and Washington markets, but for the entire country. MEMA believes that the introduction of similar legislation will only result in unnecessary, duplicative, and costly administrative burdens for your state at a time of tight budgetary constraints. Rest assured that the pending regulatory processes in California and Washington will be open and transparent, allowing you and your staff to monitor the law's implementation. Nevertheless, MEMA was overall pleased with your legislation, Madam Chair, drafted earlier this month, and which you intend to submit next year. We appreciate your willingness to model legislation after the Washington law. Still, there are still several outstanding issues which we would like to bring to your attention that are of concern to MEMA in the hopes of including additional provisions into your final bill. It is critical that affected industries have adequate time to sell the millions of dollars of current brake inventory in stock, as well as service vehicles on the road with brake pads intended for the vehicle as your bill is implemented. MEMA would like to see appropriate inventory and original equipment exemptions with identical expiration dates similar to California's. MEMA supports language exempting vehicles sold prior to the 2021 dates from its corresponding copper limits. This is mainly because it would be impossible to re-engineer and retrofit the millions of vehicles sold prior to 2021 for reformulated brake pads in order to comply with the new law. Finally, MEMA recommends language that would presume compliance in your state should Washington or California certify compliance for the same brake pads in their respective states. This would reduce additional financial burdens to manufacturers, as well as further reduce the administrative costs to your state. MEMA looks forward to working with you and your staff on this very important issue. We would like to once again express our appreciation to you, Madam Chair, and would welcome any of your questions at this time.
Thank you. And can you please make sure and submit written testimony so
we will
have that?
We wanted to also include anything that may have been brought up as part of that testimony, so we will definitely do that.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Cosgrove, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I briefly spoke at the last hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out, because I know you have a letter from the Association of International Automobile Manufacturers, which is our sister or colleagues. The Alliance is the association of the 12 of the world's leading manufacturers. And I just want to give you the names so you can identify what kind of market we're talking about. BMW, Chrysler, Ford, GM, Jaguar, Land Rover, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi, Porsche, Toyota, Volkswagen, and Volvo. So we represent about 77% of the market for cars and light trucks sold in the United States. We have supported the bill in Washington. We've had concerns about the bill in California, and I think I mentioned that briefly last time. There are still, I think, some concerns about the current draft, and Madam Chair, you mentioned there will be additional corrections. I'd just like to highlight two that I think we need to address before we would be comfortable with the current this proposal in Oregon, and one has to do with penalties. The penalties that we agreed to in the Washington bill, as I understand it, take effect at the end of this process, at the end when the final reductions are made, and they're very substantial, $100,000. I think the bill is currently drafted to take effect much earlier, and we would have some concern about that. The second issue has to do with something mentioned by Mr. Garcia. When vehicles are designed, they're designed as a system. So if there is a brake pad for a vehicle designed in the year 2010 or 2011, it needs to be replaced with that same kind of brake pad so that the whole system works throughout the life of that vehicle. And that may happen 10 years down the road, or in some cases 12 or 15 years down the road. Some of us keep our cars for a good long time. We need to make sure the exemption for older vehicles includes the pads necessary to replace in those older vehicles whenever they are replaced in that vehicle's lifespan. And I don't think the wording, I think that may be the intent of what was drafted here, but that's not what the wording is, and there's some better wording in the Washington bill. We just received a copy of the latest draft last night. I've sent it down to Sacramento and off to D.C. We may have some other comments, but at that point we'll submit something in writing that in detail addresses our concerns with detailed suggestions for language changes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
and
you.
As you have noted, it is a work in progress, so we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association and the Automotive Aftermarket Industry Association. I think there is common agreement in the goal, which is reducing the amount of copper in brake pads. I think there's even some agreement in the date, the 2021 date, as being far enough ahead that we can start looking at the technology to make this happen. We're not saying that we're there yet, but that gives us at least time to start heading that direction. And then there's the enforcement issue. One of the things that we're most concerned about, and I think you agree, and you talked about modeling your legislation after Washington, California, is when you're trying to get to a common standard at a common date, you don't want to have to get there 50 different ways. It's much better to have a single path to get there. So if different states have different deadlines or different compliance requirements, instead of having a single set of paperwork, if the brake manufacturers have to have 50 different sets of paperwork, if distribution centers, which often are regional distribution centers, have to have 50 different sets of papers to fill out in terms of compliance, it simply adds costs without benefiting the environment. So to the degree that, as the chair indicated, that we can work in concert with other states, not only in our region, but nationally, to make sure that we're all doing things the same way, it's going to reduce costs ultimately for the consumer, and it's going to make compliance a lot easier if we have a similar compliance form, for example, to make sure that the brake pads are meet the standards that we're looking at. So we support the direction you're headed. We do believe that the amount of copper in brake pads will be reduced with or without legislation in Oregon. We know from the air quality standards that vehicles have through the California Auto Emissions Board that California drives changes in the industry because of its economy. So if Washington or if California sets a standard, there isn't going to be one set of brakes sent to Oregon and a different one sent to California because of the regional distribution process. So we can benefit from what California has already done without having to take steps immediately, and potentially without having to take steps at all, we will still benefit from what is happening already in the states of California and Washington. So we would say that we don't need to be in a hurry to adopt something right away, but if we're going to adopt something in Oregon, to the degree that it looks like something that's already happening in Washington or California is going to be helpful. In terms of the current draft, there's one change that I would hope that the committee would take a look at, and that's on page 4, lines 10 through 12. It's section 4, subsection 3, and it creates a violation for selling brake pads that don't meet the standard with a fine potentially up to $10,000. We would prefer, at least at the retail end, that it would be knowingly sell, because if you're a small parts distributor or if you're a repair facility and you're buying brake pads from a reputable company and somebody from DEQ comes in and tests one of those brakes and finds out it's not in compliance, that repair shop or that part distribution storefront on Main Street, Oregon, is going to have no way of knowing or testing the brake pads that come into their shop that they're using. They're going to rely on the companies they buy from, and if they're buying from a reputable company that says that they're adhering with the standards, I think it would be unfortunate if that Main Street business could be penalized up to $10,000 for selling a product that they assumed met the standard because it says it meets the standard. So I'm just a little concerned about knowingly versus unwittingly selling brake pads that don't meet that standard at the retail level.
Okay.
And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you
have.
Great.
I think we're going to have Mr. Chamberlain come up and then, or Gallagher, sorry.
Wait. Trying to questions.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask one of you to step down, and I want to have Tom come up. Sorry.
Wrong
Tom. And then we'll take questions, and I have some comments. So, Tom, if you can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Gallagher representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. We can be supportive of legislation here that's as close as possible, and I know the drafting issues with Washington legislation, that's kind of our goal. I've been looking at this draft. I haven't sent it off to our folks to review yet. One of my concerns is that if we sell in Section 2, if a retailer sells a motor vehicle with a friction brake, and the two things that I'm going to look at and be a little worried about is what the inventory, used car inventory is for people that have these, whether or not we're responsible at that point in time for changing out all the brakes. That's, you know, that you have to look and see how that works. And secondly, again, the comments here that I heard today, what happens if the brakes can't be changed out? So the biggest concern I have for both our used cars, basically, is what happens if we have a vehicle which we have value in and we can't fix it.
Okay, great. Why don't we go to questions and then I have a comment.
Yeah, Paul, probably for you, maybe Tom, since you brought it up, I guess I'm having a little difficulty as to the testimony about the components in the brake pads being such that if you actually make a modification of the percentage of copper, reducing it or whatever, it's somehow going to impact the overall operation of the vehicle.
Madam Chair, Representative Brzezinski, Senator Brzezinski, excuse me, our point is that when you have a system like a car and its braking system, the pads are one part of that. When you then later on, 5 years, 2 years, depending on your braking habits, need to replace the pad, mm-hmm. you need to replace it with the same kind of pad that fit that system. And it is quite often, almost always true, that that will be the one that was manufactured at the time that the system was manufactured and is sitting around in warehouses for years and years and years to be those replacement parts. And it's unrealistic, and we believe in some cases perhaps even more than unrealistic, it might even be unsafe to say you have this older system that takes this kind of pad. Here's a deadline that has passed. Now that you need a new pad, and you have to do it with a different kind of pad that wasn't manufactured for that system. So in both of the other states, they have provided that cars that were manufactured before whatever deadline we're talking about can continue to be sold, and their brake pads can continue to be replaced with the kind of pads that they were made to have when they were manufactured. And I think that's the intent of this bill, but I think the language doesn't quite get there.
Any other questions?
Well, I hear everything. I mean, it seems to me that if you have a pad that's dimensionally is set for that brake, that if you change the components within that pad, but it still has the same dimensions, you're going to get the ability to still use the vehicle. Now, possibly, you may not have as long of life on the pad as you may have in the past, but I think that's what we're, I guess, is kind of like the give and take. If you want to reduce these type of metals, you may not get the same length of wear. But the configuration of the pad, I guess I'm kind of baffled as to why that would change.
Madam Chair, if I may respond. Senator Brzezinski, as you know, I'm not an auto engineer, so I'm speaking from what I have been told. But my understanding is when these pads are redesigned, these do not exist now. So we're designing them in the future. They may not be the same dimension. They may not be the same. They may be quite different in a whole different kind of system with different heat exchange capacities that require different kinds of things. In other words, it's not likely to be pad for pad change out, just slightly less copper. It's okay. A whole different system is my understanding. I'll try to get you some more information on that, what we're thinking we will be able to do in order to meet those. And perhaps Mr. Garcia has some.
That would be helpful.
Sure. Again, I'm also not an engineer, but to my understanding, that just the slightest tweak of a brake pad system is enough to.
Guys, here, I mean, the reality, we have an aftermarket already. Mm-hmm. I bet you right now I can go out and find four different pads that can go on virtually every car, and I bet you that the components that are in those pads are not exactly the same. Because if they were, you probably wouldn't see something that could be undercut or charged at a lesser price, and that's just the reality of aftermarket.
Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I know the aftermarket people are equally concerned about this provision because they say they're manufacturing their pads to meet the specifications of the car and the pads at the time it was originally manufactured. I know that's one of the concerns they had in Washington, is the aftermarket folks didn't get the right exemption either. So I think it's an important issue. We may need to give you some more information, but I think we need to make sure we do it right so we don't have a problem.
Questions?
Great.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. No questions on this end. So I hate to say this, but one of the things is we aren't reinventing the wheel here. It has been obviously done in two other states to our north and south, and I'm very confident that these issues came up in those discussions. So I think and to respond to your comment about is this legislation necessary, working several, I think three or four sessions ago on energy efficiency standards for the state of Oregon, one of the reasons that where the state of Washington and California had both passed those, one of the concerns that we have, being the small state that we are, is making sure that we don't become the dumping ground for cars that do have copper. And the hearing before this, as you know, we're investing millions and millions of dollars in restoring our watersheds throughout the state. Main concern, one of the big concerns about heavy metals in our streams is the impact on salmon populations, which we're spending a lot of public dollars to restore. So I appreciate the comments, certainly, and with all due respect, hope that you're willing to work with the state of Oregon to make sure that we're consistent. I do believe that there's some benefits to having consistency on the West Coast, because if the federal government does ever eventually act, I believe that they would look to the work that we're doing here on the West Coast to be consistent. And I also believe that that'll happen when other states are looking at it, in my experience working on other legislation where the state is often the lead. On computer recycling, where we've been the lead on that, and I've worked very closely with Mr. Cosgrove, as we have the wounds on that, scars on that discussion, but that's the intent here. And so we will, yes.
Scars.
Oh, two, yeah, the two of you.
Scars. I have the
so my intent is, yes, you have the wounds, he has the scars. My intent is first week of January, because I won't impose on you during the holidays, but what would be helpful is to make sure you provide us all the comments by the end of the year. My ABLE staff will be contacting you so we can put together a work group the first week of January and hopefully be able to get amendments to clarify. Certainly appreciate all the comments we've heard here today. Tom?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, if I could just add one thing on Senator Przanski, and it has nothing to do with the brakes and the content of the brakes. In that sense, that's an environmental issue. I spend more of my time on the consumer protection side, and I want to try to bring the two pieces together. For new car dealers and for newer used cars, we very much like to use the manufacturer specifications and so forth, and it becomes a consumer issue. So replacing it with aftermarket brakes that may not quite match the design of the manufacturer and so forth is something we would want to disclose to people. We'd want to explain why. And the other thing on the consumer side is that if the brakes don't work as well and they have an impact and we're doing repair work in our shops, then we're going to have consumer complaints. And I want to be able not to use consumer complaints to denigrate the environment, but I want to be able to bring the two of them together so that we end up out there with all the constituents and our customers knowing what they're getting and how they're getting it. So I don't know the technical details here. I just know that's the only thing I'm concerned about.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. So we will see you. First week of January is my goal, and appreciate all your input. We'll look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we're moving on to farmland. We're this committee, we cover all the issues here. So next we're going to hear from a group that's been working diligently during the interim on an issue that came before our committee last session, and this is about commercial activities on farmland. If you recall, we had several bills that dealt with exceptions. There's been many, many, many bills throughout this legislature, many bills over many sessions that have to do with exceptions on farmland. So the Association of Oregon Counties put together a Farmland Activities Task Force. Art Schlack from AOC is going to provide an update on that, and I think with him, Mike Brandt from Yamhill County is the planning director. Then we're also going to hear, I think, from the Farm Bureau, if they're here briefly, and the Oregon Wine Growers. Art, good to see you again. It's been a whole day.
Yeah. Yeah, we had to spend yesterday afternoon together, didn't
we? I know. It's a pleasure. See you again.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties at this point, and you will be receiving two pieces of information. One is a memorandum from Commissioner Mary Stern, who is the chair of the Farmland Activities Task Force. Unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, she won't be able to be here today because she's out of the continental United States taking a well-deserved vacation after her re-election campaign, et cetera. So there's a memo from her and then a copy of the final report that you have that was accepted by the AOC board on Monday of this week at this point.
And do we have, is Mike Brandt here?
Unfortunately,
he couldn't be here
either. Mr. Brandt.
Okay.
I just got off the phone
to both
from
of them.
Him
okay.
and with him, and he was in transit, and unfortunately he won't be able because
okay. that's
traffic
fine.
Won't be able to get here in time.
That's fine.
So, with that as a little bit of background, Chair Dingvoyer, you gave some of the reasons why AOC moved to establish the task force, and actually the interest in the task force by the association started in the fall of 2009 in response to a large discussion by a number of counties that were facing issues with respect to how do you manage or how do you permit and what kinds of activities are appropriate on farmland at this point.
That's why I came
We had a large discussion at the fall conference of AOC in 2009. You'll recall in February of 2010 there was legislation proposed dealing with wineries and activities in response to, again, concerns that were out in the community about what is appropriate in terms of activities and events at on farmland at this point, not just wineries necessarily. And I would just note for you that this has grown to a point where there were enforcement actions being taken, there were court cases being filed in a number of counties dealing with events and activities on farmland. So all of these coupled together brought the Association of Oregon Counties to respond to create a task force to look at these issues, and you can see... actually, if we talk about the task force report, the reasons why or the charge that the board gave the Farmland Activities Task Force was to review the current patterns of use on farmlands to assess the impacts and compatibility of agricultural tourism on farming operations and the farming community, to identify infrastructure needed to support appropriate uses in agricultural areas, and to develop recommendations to minimize these conflicts. So that was the charge to the task force. As I mentioned, Commissioner Mary Stern from Yamhill County was designated as the chair of the task force. And the task force, Exhibit A in the report, has a list of task force members, and it also has a list of interested parties at this point. The task force membership itself was comprised primarily of county commissioners, and also from representatives of a number of state agencies like the Department of Agriculture, DLCD, Human Resources Department. There were a number of state agencies that are involved in or have interest in activities that take place on farmland that were part of the task force, as well as the Farm Bureau was members. So that gives you maybe a quick idea of some of the people that participated. The task force worked from April until actually just completed their work. As I indicated, we just presented the final report to the AOC board this last Monday. One of the things that the task force asked was for a survey of counties to identify types of activities that were taking place, I'll say the concerns, issues, infrastructure requirements, and how things were being permitted. And what we found was that if you look at state statute and administrative rules as it relates to agricultural lands, EFU lands, it's fairly specific, but it is somewhat gray when it comes to activities and events that can take place on agricultural lands. And so in looking at what counties were doing, some counties were trying to be, shall we say, a little bit creative in terms of how they would review requests for events and activities. Some activities just happened, and that's where we got into, you know, questions and concerns from adjacent property owners and the community at large. And in some instances, counties were saying, you can't do that. And so we had a variety of things, and we found, the task force found, that it wasn't really clear in terms of authority for counties to consider some of these events and activities on farmland based on the current statutes and administrative rules at this point. You'll find a set of principles that was adopted by the task force to kind of guide its work. And in addition to the seven, I believe, principles that are identified, one of the overarching principle was to try and treat, let's say, farming activities the same, rather than to create, shall we, and I've heard the word silos today, silos for this type of agriculture and that type of agriculture, so that wineries have one thing, and if you are raising beef, you have something else, and if you are raising flowers, you have something else at this point. And try and create a level playing field so that people that were looking at events and activities to supplement, let's say, income on farmland would have an opportunity to ask for permits to conduct those kinds of activities at this point. A lot of discussion about whether there should be, because we have regional differences at this point, farming in the valley is different from farming in, you know, in terms of in eastern Oregon, but there are farmland throughout the state. The task force did not come to any consensus. We're able to really, within the time allowed, to deal with regional differences kinds of questions at this point. So what the task force the task force concluded is that there was a need to provide for some clarification and actually to provide additional opportunities for counties to consider permitting events and activities on farmland. And the product of the task force was to develop a legislative concept that you'll find that starts on page 5 of the of the report. And I want to emphasize that the legislative concept is one that is optional, that would provide an opportunity for counties but not require counties to adopt the concepts that are put forth here. If a county finds that it has in its ordinances and requirements adequate opportunity, then, you know, they may choose not to adopt these provisions if they're made available at this point, but it certainly would create a much greater opportunity for counties to consider whether it's appropriate and under what circumstances would be appropriate to conduct activities and events on farmland. As I indicated, the legislative concept that is being forwarded is starts on page 5, and I've kind of over the time is described this as three legs of a stool and that would provide additional opportunities, additional tools, if you will, in the toolbox for county planning departments to review and consider the events and activities. One of the things that we found initially was that the under ORS 215-283 sub 2, which is the conditional uses that are allowed on farmland, that the commercial activity in conjunction with farm, because of some court interpretations and decisions at this point, is fairly limited as to what you can do. You can do like farm implements and sales and those kinds of things as a conditional use in a farming area, but It is rather restrictive when it comes to events or activities. And so the first leg of the stool would be to amend 215.283 sub 2A to clarify that commercial activities may include the promotion of farm use if the activities are subordinate to the primary farm use on the tract of land at this point. And it's the intent here that by adding this language that events and activities that, again, are promoting agricultural use, farm use, on the tract, and that would be appropriate to be considered as a commercial activity in conjunction with farm. The second leg of the stool, and we recognize that not everything can be viewed necessarily the same. The 215.283 sub 2 is the conditional use which runs with the land, and it is something that's much more permanent in nature and can basically be something that includes a number of components at this point and can take place all the time, every day. But we recognize a lot of these events and activities are somewhat limited in scope and nature, and so it would be appropriate to create what is determined to be or what is suggested to be a limited use permit. And this permit would be for events and activities that would be for a limited number of occasions during the year, and it's suggested in the draft here that it not exceed 6 events a year. Each event could last or be for up to 72 hours at this point. Would also note that while this is a land use decision because it's discretionary in nature, that it would be personal to the applicant and not run with the land like a normal conditional use permit would be. So that if the property was sold and the new owner would have to reapply if he wanted to continue conducting the events and activities on the land. Also, there is a provision for a 2-year review of these permits at this point. So that's the second leg of the stool, and this would be a new section under the conditional use pieces. The third leg of the stool is for the single event. So somebody wants to have one event during a calendar year, and we tried to make this fairly easy because you want to be able to get some permits in a relatively short period of time. And there is an option here that's identified, and I want to speak to that. Under a single permit, again, this would be a land use decision, but it is limited to the one time, and it's personal. And there's a limitation on the number of people and vehicles, et cetera, and there's some review criteria that are established. What is provided on page 6 under sub 2 is an opportunity for a non-land use permit for a single event at this point. This is the intent to, on a very, that's how I'll say, limited or narrow basis for an event that would take place, that if you met the criteria that are laid out, that permit basically could be issued over the counter within a day at this point, if you met the requirements at this point. And so it would be straightforward. Again, it would not be a land use decision. It would not be subject to appeal and review at this point. So that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is the concept at this point that has is the product of the task force. As I indicated, it's been accepted. We presented this task force report to the House Agricultural Committee yesterday, and it's my understanding that there is an LC that they have are having put forth as a committee bill. So we would start the discussion of the farmland activities recommendations in the House and look forward to a continued discussion with the Senate. So I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Art. And just a couple of questions, and I know that there'll be probably a bit of work done in the House before it gets over here, but certainly whoever the chair is or co-chairs are going to be over there, I'll be working closely with them because this is an issue that we worked on quite a bit. Senator Boquist spent a bit of time working on this issue last session, and she has the scars to show for that one. But I do have a question about, and we're going to ask a couple other folks to come up, but is there consensus on the work group about this legislation at this point?
Madam Chair, there is consensus of the work group to advance this proposal. The task force, there was not a vote, but the chair did go around and ask all the members of the task force. Again, I draw a distinction, if you will, between members of the task force and the interested parties at this point. There was some concerns, needless to say, expressed. Continue to work with, let's say, other people that have concepts that you'll hear about, like the Wine Growers Association.
And those are separate concepts
at this point. We've had discussions about those. There are a number of pieces that we concur with. There are a couple of pieces, a couple of elements at this point that we have differences of opinion. And I guess I would just take this opportunity to identify what I think is probably the most significant one at this point, and that has to do with commercial kitchens. The task force, after much discussion, believes that commercial kitchens should be authorized, if you will, through the conditional use permit process and not be an outright permitted use. And there's a number of reasons for that, but that's probably the most significant one there. And you'll see in the report there's a paragraph that talks about some of these things. But that's probably the biggest one where there's a difference of opinion, not in the fact that maybe you shouldn't have them, but the question is what's the process to be able to have those and what the implications of those are long term if you have commercial kitchens in terms of other kinds of activities and those kinds of things. And the one thing about the land use system, whether some people love it, some people hate it for various reasons, but it is an opportunity to bring the community together to have a discussion about an event or an activity and to look at the need for mitigation and to ensure that things like public health, public safety, sanitation requirements, and all those kinds of things are reviewed. One other quick thing is there was a lot of discussion in the task force about health, public health. And there you'll see in the recommendations, which is kind of a discussion we hope to have offline with the Department of Agriculture and Human Services, is who does inspections for the public health kinds of things. And the task force believes that that should happen. The inspections should happen through the county health department at this point, and through the health department rather than Department of Agriculture. And I think there's agreement on that. So it's just a question of, let's say, counties getting together with the Department of Agriculture and Human Services to the point where we have an agreement and can implement that. It's not something that's part of the legislative concept.
All right. Thank you, Art. We'll see if there's some questions, but I do want to thank you for your leadership on this. I know it's been a lot of work. My staff has been able to attend some of the meetings, and I'm looking forward to, I'm sure we're going to have more discussions as the legislation is submitted on the House side, but I think it's important that we have a resolution to some of these issues because they have been recurring over many sessions here, and I think an interest in trying to resolve these, some of these issues, I think that can be sort of put to rest in consistent legislation. So I'll be interested to see what comes over from the House. We're going to hear from just a couple other parties real briefly. I didn't want to bring up everybody who's been involved in this because I'm sure that there'll be many, many changes in legislative concept before it comes over here. But that, we'll see if there's some questions for Art.
Madam Chair, I'm going to hold my questions. It sounds like this is a big work in progress. I have a lot of questions and issues, but I don't think we need to try to go after them today.
Okay.
And we would be happy to meet. I would be happy to meet with Senator Przanski or any members of the committee at this point that hopefully will be involved next session on this issue. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank Beth for attending, I believe, almost all of the task force meetings and to provide information to you, Senator Dingfelder, along the line. So that was greatly appreciated that we had the input from both the House committee and the Senate committee that would be interested in this.
And I would ask you to visit with committee members once this legislation, I'm assuming the draft isn't available yet.
The draft is a work in progress
at
this point.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just going to ask a couple more folks to come up. We have the Wine Growers Association, Gary Conkling, and I guess Dan. Yep. And then after that, I'm going to ask the Farm Bureau and ODA to come up and just if they want to say a few comments on the work in progress. And then again, we'll have more discussion about this next session. Thank you, gentlemen. And I'm going to ask, we're tight on time, so if you can keep your comments brief. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, because I don't want to wait for the presentation to come up with our technical challenges in this room and
all right.
Maybe a while.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, joined by Dan Jarman, both representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. We were going to split the duty here a little bit and just quickly give you what we've done internally in our industry since the supplemental session and passage of Senate Bill 1055, and then the product of that is a legislative concept that I'd like to outline, but I'm going to defer to Dan to just give a quick overview of our internal process.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Dan Jarman representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. The presentation should be up in a moment. Just briefly before we talk about our OWA member survey, just some general background about the state of the Oregon wine industry. So here in Oregon, we have close to 400 wineries with close to 20,000 acres of planted vineyards. In 2009, the latest figures we have, the wine industry produced more than 1.6 million cases of wine and harvested more than 40,000 tons of grapes. That equates to 8,500 jobs in the wine industry statewide, $200 million in wages, adding $1.4 billion to the Oregon economy. So it's an important part of the Oregon economy. Our association we're a statewide trade association. You have I just informed committee members have the presentation, so thank you. We have 138 winery and vineyard members, 48 members who are winery only members, and 116 vineyard owner only members. Our regions include the Willamette Valley, both north and south, Umpqua Valley, Rogue Valley, Columbia Valley, Eastern Oregon, and Walla Walla. I wanted to go into the findings that we had, as Gary indicated, after the passage of Senate Bill 1055 and knowing there was going to be a conversation about activities on farmland. We felt it was important for us to talk to our members first to get a sense of what our members felt about these issues, and both prospectively, but also what they're doing today. Just a little background: the wine industry is maturing, but there's lots of new entrants. As you can see in the slides that you have, about 30% of the industry members have been around for 20 plus years. So there's lots of players who have developed this industry who are leading the way. But at the same time, about 40% of the members of the wine industry here in the state have been around for less than 10 years. So lots of new players, lots of small players, boutique wineries that sort of are adding to the mix of the new and the old. Most of the wineries, as you can imagine, are located in Yamhill County, followed by robust efforts in Jackson County, Douglas County, and Polk counties, both wineries and vineyards.
As far as commercial activities, lots of conversations about, so what are the wineries doing in conjunction with the farming practices at the winery plus making the wine. 70% of wineries are doing something, which means 30% have no tasting rooms. It's just winery operations altogether. It's a combination of another 10% have only tasting rooms. 18% of the wineries have tasting rooms and also retail space where they're selling their wine products and other incidental products. About 10% have tasting rooms but also event space to do some of these commercial activities that we've talked about. And then finally, about 30% of the wineries have tasting rooms, retail space, and event space as well. Very interesting figure that we got in surveying our members that of the winery's total wine sales, 45% of those sales are coming from the winery itself on-site sales. Very interesting number as far as we're concerned. I think that shows you the importance that wineries place on bringing customers to their wineries to come to the tasting rooms, to participate in activities at their wineries where they can develop an appreciation for the wines and become loyal and long-time customers. I think when you talk about nearly half of all of their wine sales happening at the facility, I think it shows how important it is for the wine industry to be able to bring those customers out to their facilities, most of which on EFU land. As you know, during the 1055 discussion, there was lots of talk about so how much revenue or income are wineries deriving from these events or sales of non-wine-related items as a percentage of their total on-site wine sales. And as you can see in the, I don't know if the color came out in your handout, but for more than half of the wineries, 54%, they're achieving less than 5%, 5% or less on these incidental activities. And as you can see in the numbers, it ranges from less than 5 up to 25%, and only 4% of these wineries are actually deriving income greater than 25% of their on-site sales. So lots of questions during the discussion on 1055 about how much income they're deriving from this, and I think it's fair to say and that most are not getting the kind of numbers that some had assumed and doing a lot of sales out on the wineries compared to their total on-site wine sales. And then finally, just one more important stat that we learned from surveying our members, the importance of events to commercial activities. Our members, 75% of them, say that the ability to have events and do these commercial activities, 75% thinks it's very important or somewhat important to the commercial viability of the wine industry. And if you compare that to the fact that right now they're not making a great amount of income on these things, I think it still shows that the future of it is very important for the wine industry that they're able to bring these customers out to their facilities. So just to one more point before I turn it over to Gary, separate from events, and we haven't, as you know, sort of talked about a definition of events, but I wanted to just highlight some of the activities happening at the wineries that are important to the marketing and promotion of the wines, because I think it's clearly something that we need to continue to talk about in that definition of events, because our wineries are doing things at their facilities that are directly related to trying to market and promote their wines. Those can range from hosting distributors and brokers at their facilities, educating sales teams and their tasting room staff, hosting wine writers or wine critics, hosting tours and tastings, entertaining investors and volunteers, and building relationships with these loyal customers that I talked about a moment ago through cellar club events, special release parties, winemaker dinners. Those are things that wineries believe are very important to the day-to-day operations of their business to, again, market and promote their wines. And I think we need to have the conversation of, so what does that mean in the big picture of events? And our members would, I think, believe that those are things that are outside of sort of the events that most are talking about. And so how that plays into this discussion moving forward, I think, is very important. So we wanted to highlight to you some of those those activities that are happening at wineries related specifically to marketing, promoting, and selling of wines. I'll turn it over to Gary now to sort of talk about our legislative concept and how we got there.
Gary, you have about 3 minutes to wrap up because we're really running out of time.
I'll do it very quickly.
Yeah.
Based on a survey and a series of town meetings with our members, we developed a set of concepts, which I'll run over quickly, the guiding principles of which were our members feel very strongly about the importance of maintaining farmland. We are farmers, but also allowing the commercial activities that are important for us to sell the product of our farm. We feel strongly about maintaining the minimum acreage requirement of 15 contiguous acres, but as Dan has described, we also are looking for a way to preserve our ability to do the kinds of activities that have become now, for many wineries, normal business activities. So our legislative concept deals with provisions that are specifically tied to ORS 215-452, with one exception, where the overlap with the permitting process that the previous witness talked about. Our particular concept about how to deal with events is, instead of trying to identify what they are, put them into a package, is basically to exclude from what permitted use wineries could do the types of events that seem to be the biggest concern, namely weddings, concerts, now I'm talking about outdoor ticketed concerts, and rental facilities, which under our construct would be subject to a temporary or limited use permit of the type that Mr. Schlack described. But the permitted use winery would be able to conduct its normal business, the activities that we described earlier, and that would be an understood part of our privilege. The statute also, as it sits today, does not expressly reference tasting rooms, which we think is an oversight. The 25% limitation, which was introduced in Senate Bill 1055, which serves as a backstop to make sure that our facilities don't become event centers, we believe should be retained. I'm going to deal with the commercial great appliance thing last, but let me touch on one other issue. As our industry has matured, we have a handful of wineries that have grown over the 100,000 limit. That growth has not necessarily coincided with any enlargement of its production footprint, but it does represent an interesting no man's land of what happens if you one year produce 105,000 gallons or 115,000 gallons. Does that mean you're no longer a permitted use winery? Do you need to go get a conditional use permit? What would the conditional use permit cover relative that you're not doing anything different than you were the year before when maybe your production was at 90,000? So our less than brilliant solution, but at least elegant, is to just push the number from 100,000 to 150,000 gallons, which our assessment doesn't really represent much change in the production footprint of most places. They would have that capacity, and it sort of eliminates the no-man land. Finally, on the issue that Mr. Schlack referenced about commercial kitchens, it's less about maybe commercial kitchens than many of our wineries already have commercial-grade appliances, because if you have a winemaker dinner or you're hosting cellar club events, you may have caterers and that kind of thing. To get the right kind of public health permits, you're going to need, if nothing else, commercial-grade dishwashers. Oftentimes, you need ovens to make sure food is properly heated or kept heated and that type of thing. So what we're trying to suggest is that the presence, which already exists in many wineries, of this type of equipment in and of itself should be treated no differently other than in a building permit or subsequently looking in a public health permit, but shouldn't be treated any differently with respect to the basic permitted use of a winery under this statute.
A question, Gary, and again, I know that this is, I haven't seen the concept, so I'm assuming it's not available yet.
Madam Chair, it's into Legislative Council, but had some technical drafting problems.
And it, are you planning to submit that on the Senate side or the House side or at this point?
Madam Chair, I don't know that we especially have decided that. We were waiting to see what the House was going to do. If, in fact, the House is going to take up the county proposal, as I indicated in setting this up, there's a portion of our concept that overlaps with that. And so it might make sense to have both of them looked at. We will have a separate bill, and I don't know what the relating clause is to the other provision, but the provisions that we've described here generally relate to the winery siting provisions in current law.
Now, I think that would be helpful to keep them together as a package, actually. But anyway, we'll see if there's any questions before we call up a couple of final folks to comment. Senator Boquist, since you worked on this, certainly.
If you're calling up a couple more people, I think I'll wait.
Well, it's Farm Bureau. So as far as on the winery issue, you may want to, if it's specific to that.
The only observation, having been tarred and feathered on this issue, which was not an issue of my district, unless there's some sort of, we'll say, overlapping, as Mr. Conkling just said, and some of the issues that both Senator Prezansky and I reviewed during the last session, it's problematic. Very problematic. It has to resolve some issues because if I understood, which we're meeting later, what he just said, I'm going to get tarred and feathered royally in my district if several things don't happen still. So.
I appreciate that. And I got tarred and feathered
for having nothing to do with it and trying to get a compromise last time. Only this time I'd really get tarred and feathered by my own people because I see that some of the suggestions were going to create a larger problem, at least in one of my counties. I will openly say that I have two counties on exactly opposite sides of this.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and look, even though I know you won't be on the committee, I'm hopeful that you'll be involved with this issue because I think it's important to remain that, have that continuity. So I encourage you. I think it's important to make sure that we try to resolve some of these issues that are still outstanding, and hopeful that we have a little bit of time before the session starts so we can do that. Any other questions? Okay. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more as this progresses. And I'm just going to ask the Farm Bureau and Department of Ag if they can come up. Do you want to add any comments? Again, I know this is a work in progress, but...
I still didn't hear a solution for your big winery and my big winery.
Right.
It's going to happen. I assure you it will happen. Don't have to put it on the record right now, but it will happen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Whoever wants to go first...
Good morning, Senator Dinkfelder and committee members. My name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I didn't expect to provide any comments today, but that's fine. So I don't have enough copies for the audience. What I just had handed out to you is the Board of Agriculture's resolution that's dealing with the siting of agritourism events. And I think it's very important because it's the direction that the board has and the department has been working for over 2 years now. This has been a discussion item with the Board of Agriculture for a great period of time. I think some of the issues that Senator Boquist was kind of referring to, you know, came right into the Board of Agriculture. And when you look at the makeup of the Board of Agriculture, it's very diverse. There are an awful lot of issues dealing with the siting of agritourism-related events to the operation of agricultural activities within farm areas. Looking at the two, for lack of term, concepts that you've heard about coming from both AOC, which we were a member of the working group, and then with the winery groups, I would just say that there are elements in both of those concepts that we believe we can support, but we also believe that neither one goes far enough. There needs to be some additional things addressed and some other items are concerned. So a blending is probably going to be appropriate of what you're hearing about in terms of from the wine industry and from AOC. One of the big concerns that we heard from the ag industry in general is, and you heard Art Schlack talk about uneven application. It is an issue with the agricultural community, and it's not just the fact that things are being interpreted differently from county to county, which would be addressed by some of the provisions dealt with by AOC, but it's also the effect that some counties have chosen to be more restrictive than others. And when you talk to operators in one county that have the ability to do agritourism, and in another county they're not allowed to do that, many in the ag community think that's an unfair competitive advantage. They can't do the same type of marketing activities because a county chose to be more restrictive. So we're a little bit concerned with the AOC proposal that would say that some of these things would be optional from county to county as opposed to required to be applied consistently from county to county in terms of a competitive advantage situation. So that is one issue we have. Another issue that we will want to look really hard at is the use of the commercial use in conjunction with farm use provision to allow marketing activities and the like. That's really still leaves an awful lot of interpretation in terms of what those events are, and that's been part of the problem in terms of some of the things that are out there that really have no relationship to agriculture and are not subordinate. I think that AOC has come a long ways towards defining a couple of those terms, but those will be some things we look at. But bottom line, I just want to end by paraphrasing where the Board of Agriculture was or is on this. They're very concerned in general about the siting of these activities and on farmland and want them to be limited, but understand their need. And so really the circumstances that they are looking at are these types of activities need to be in conjunction with commercial farm use, and I really emphasize that term commercial. We're not talking of farm use should be the primary use, and these uses should be subordinate to agriculture. And the other real concern that the industry has is that even when these things are cited, if they can't be found to be compatible with surrounding farming operations or made to be compatible with surrounding farming operations, that there needs to be some real concern about the siting of those out there. If one activity is having impositions on surrounding farming activities, then we're really concerned about the long-term viability of the industry as a whole in our region as opposed to an individual operator. So I'll end with that.
Hey, Sean?
For the record, Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. We participated in the AOC process. I think that made good strides towards finding some resolutions, as Mr. Johnson said. The Farm Bureau doesn't have any position yet on either of the concepts. We do recognize that there is some issues. I think generally the issues arise because of the inconsistent application from county to county. And one of the things that I advocated for during the process was that we need a consistency of process, not necessarily of outcomes, so that people felt like they were their application was being processed just as their neighbor would be, regardless of which county the property might be in. We do have some general concerns, as always, about the conflicts, and we see the EFU zone as a good system to mitigate those conflicts. As we add any new use in the EFU zone, there's just more opportunities for conflict, generally, regardless of what those are. So we'd have some concerns about that, and our focus as we work with whichever chamber, whichever work group will be providing those suggestions for sideboards so that we can mitigate those conflicts if they do arise. So.
All right. Any other comments, questions for the panel? I will say that depending on where this legislation starts, I mean, it is somewhat disappointing that, frankly, I was hoping the Department of Ag would take the leadership on this because this is an issue that I think needs everybody sitting at the table together resolving some of these issues. You know, we are a part-time legislature. I would like to say that we have the staff and the ability to pull everybody together on all these issues, but unfortunately that doesn't always happen. So if you have any comments on it, the board has been very involved in this. I mean, I don't want to see this go on for subsequent sessions, frankly, and I'm hoping that we can get some resolution. I'm committed to it. If it ends up being starting in the Senate, then I may just force all you guys to get in a room together and say nothing's coming out until we get some resolution here. But that may be beyond my control.
Senator Dingfelder, I would respond to that. last legislative session, the department did offer to lead this in both the House side and the Senate side. The decision was ultimately made, or we were kind of directed that to let the AOC work group play out before anything else go beyond that. So we are definitely interested and committed to working this out, and we're available to, you know, to be in the middle of however, whatever process you want there. But the Board of Agriculture has been working on this much longer than any other group.
And I would just echo the chair's concerns that I think process-wise it makes sense to have a continue the conversation. Obviously, some work needs to be done before January if we're going to take a big stab at this during session. But Farm Bureau is ready and willing to participate. And the nice thing about the conversation today is that it is almost a direct repeat of the conversation in the House yesterday. So,
well, I will be talking to whoever my House counterparts are, and hopefully we'll know that soon. And I will be talking to, following up with the Department of Ag to make sure that, I mean, the advantage of the fact that we will not be having official hearings on this until February gives us a little more time to work on it. Mm-hmm. And I'd much prefer to, if we can bring the parties together, if it means working through January, that be the case. But I will need the help of the department because we have limited staff to do this. You know, I wish I could clone Beth. Because she's
so do we.
Yeah, but the reality is you have a lot much more resources than we have through this committee to work on this, and obviously being the one of the agencies, I certainly know that the department, the land conservation, there's obviously land use elements as well, but it's important that the agencies work together on this as well. So I will be following up with my House counterparts once we know who those are, and be following up with you on this. I appreciate your work. Everybody who's worked on this so far, I think we have some more work to do. I look forward to working with you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Chair's prerogative, since we're on land use, I'm actually going to ask Richard Whitman to come up and give a very brief, and I know he will be brief, except, oh, here he is. Thought he left, so here we go. And I'm going to ask if the water quality folks can hold on. And then we are going to lose some members, so we're going to have to open up a work session to adopt committee bills before we go on to some of the other items on our agenda. But I've asked Director Whitman to come up. Many of you know we've had a destination resort work group that's taken up quite a bit of our time of this interim session. Appreciate that we have many members of the work group in the audience today. We're really going to just ask Director Whitman if he can provide a brief update, and then we're going to move on because, again, this is still a work in progress. We've had excellent, I will say, my many years working in the legislature, this has been one of the, I don't know if I want to say hardest working work groups that I've ever been involved with, but I've been very impressed with the dedication of the work group members. We have very diverse views at the table, but I will say that the discussion has been excellent, and we've really been dealing with some very challenging policy issues. So I want to thank the director and his staff for working with us, along with my staff. It's taken up quite a bit of time. We don't have an LC concept in front of you because it's still a work in progress, but hopefully we will by the start of session. So I've asked the director to just provide a brief update. I'm actually not going to ask any work group members to come up at this time because we still are work in progress, but granted, you will be coming up during the session to provide input. But I just wanted to have the director provide a brief update for committee members.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I want to echo your sentiments about the work that's been done by this group. I think a large part of the outcome that we're headed toward is really building some relationships between people that I think will serve us well working on this and related issues over the long term. For now, the work group has focused its efforts on a particular part of the Destination Resort Program in Oregon. We've spent a fair amount of time looking at the large resort issues, but I think at this point, recognizing that that's too big a lift in this amount of time, we're really focusing on the small resort component of the Destination Resort Program, which has existed as part of the program from the outset, but which notably has not been used by a single developer in the state of Oregon since it was adopted. And there are some particular reasons for that. The small resorts are only allowed on, right now, on non-resource or exception land. And exception land in rural areas, you can already do a commercial, it's not too hard to do a commercial type development of a type that's quite similar to a resort. So there's not a whole lot of incentive there. We've had some really good ideas come out of the work group in terms of more sustainable models for smaller resorts. And so what the work group is really trying to do is take advantage of some of that innovation and energy in terms of new models for small resorts and come up with a concept that provides for that to actually occur in some parts of Oregon, really as an economic development tool, particularly for rural Oregon, where we've got very high levels of unemployment. The main pieces of the small resort model that we're looking at are to open it up so that small resorts are allowed on forest land. That would be probably the biggest change. They would not be allowed on the best forest land, but they would be allowed on forest land, and that we think would make this a much more realistic opportunity for rural Oregon. The other big thing about small resorts is that they can be done without local government going through an expensive, time-consuming mapping comprehensive plan amendment process. They basically could be cited as a conditional use by counties around the state without a whole lot of expense and planning work to put that in place. And then the third piece of this is that we would roll it out as a pilot. This would allow a limited number of resorts around the state with these constraints and over a period of time so that we can see how it works. And then with the requirement that we come back and look at how the program is working or what problems there are with the program and make appropriate corrections. So that's Chair Dingfelder. I'm happy to go into more detail if you want, but that's a very high-level summary of the concept that the work group is focused on right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions for the director?
Not at this time.
Okay. Great. Well, we will obviously look forward to hearing more during the next session, but look forward to working with all you. And again, thanks to the work group who spent a lot of time. It's work in progress, and we'll be having another meeting here in a few weeks. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask the water quality folks to come up, and then we'll take we will open up a work session for the bills after that. Okay, thank you for your patience. Apologize about running over. We're going to try to make up the time. This is a very important issue. We heard a little bit about it last session, so I'd ask the department to come back and provide an update on what's going on with water quality and algal blooms in the state of Oregon. So, Director, I'll let you take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. Actually, we're going to, with your permission, we're going to ask Sue Marshall to go first, then I'll follow Sue, and then Mr. Coote will follow me.
All right, great. Thank you, Sue. Welcome back.
My name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Tualatin Riverkeepers. I would like to just provide a little update on a background on Tualatin Riverkeepers' concern about this issue. It's been about a year since we were before this committee. I'd like to talk about some of the gaps that were identified by the work group and then end on an opportunity. For the Tualatin Riverkeepers, we promoted some legislation in the 09 session, House Bill 2945, and then subsequently came before you in an informal interim committee meeting. The concerns from the Tualatin Riverkeepers' perspective stemmed from a 2008 serious blue-green algae outbreak, the likes of which hadn't been seen. We'd seen an algae, but we hadn't seen anything that really shut down all of the uses of the and impacted the uses of the river. The Tualatin Riverkeepers were rather stunned by the confusion both among the local and state agencies. There was confusion about whose responsibility it was and also delay in reacting to the algal bloom as well. There was a delay in posting the advisory. Actually, it came to the Tualatin Riverkeepers to download the advisory notice and post that at some of the public access points in the more populated areas as the algae bloom was moving down to those areas. Although the source of the problem was identified, it was actually reduced, but it was never stopped. It continued to discharge throughout the summer season. There were some serious economic impacts. The drinking water that supplies the city of Hillsboro, Alloa, and parts of Beaverton had to do some additional treatment. The water, the drinking water itself, there was a color and odor that were associated with the drinking water. Approximately $285,000 were spent for additional treatment. Intel was impacted as well. They had to do some additional treatment. We don't have a dollar figure on that. Farmer Steve Dyke, who farms in rural Washington County, I've attached rather harrowing his personal experience and exposure to the contaminated water that impacted his health. And also he was very concerned as he continued to irrigate his crops, some of which went to market. He was not sure whether or not these toxins would persist in his crops, and he had difficulty actually being able to find answers to his questions. Additionally, Alder Creek, which rents kayaks and canoes, had to shut down for several weeks. I've attached a summary of the Tualatin River's experience, as well as Steve Dyke's experience. As for the work group, we focused on freshwater harmful algae blooms. I've attached a list of the participants and as well a brainstorm list of some of the gaps that were discussed in the course of our three meetings. We met first to discuss testing, notification, public awareness. Second meeting dealt with prevention and water quality, and then finally gaps. I would like to just highlight three of the gaps that were identified and then sum up. Timeliness of testing, I think, was something that came up again and again. There is an agreement that provides temporary funding from DEQ's TMDL program to enable some emergency testing to occur in DEQ's lab. There are significant time delays because there testing is not done within the state. While there are lab facilities, it's cheaper to send them out of state. It takes, as we understand, 2 to 3 days to receive toxin results, 4 days to 2 weeks to receive cell counts. This timeliness of testing is really important so that as quickly as you can have an accurate assessment of the degree of risk to the public, post an advisory, and potentially you could narrow where the actual risk occurs so there's not a blanket posting in, of the waters. Funding is very much a need, and the funding really is needed to support a comprehensive program. There's multiple agencies that deal with this issue. It needs to be integrated both at the state and the local water manager level. I would like to commend the agencies. They've done, I think, a good job in trying to find some grant funds to close some of the gaps, but we do think it's a stopgap measure, and there needs to be, as these grants run out, an ongoing focus on this issue. There are serious information gaps. We didn't really have a chance to talk in very much depth about agricultural issues, but the gaps in information really stem to the safety of for agricultural workers themselves, whether or not food crops are taking up these toxins, what is the risk from some level of contamination in our food. And we wonder really if the agricultural community has access to information related to harmful algal blooms. I think overall the work group wanted to convey to you that this is a really serious issue that impacts communities in economic ways, both in individuals, the local industry base, and recreational uses. The toxic substances that are produced by these harmful algal blooms is very, very strong. I can't think of anything that poses a more immediate and severe risk to the public as when these blooms and the toxins occur. Waters that are vulnerable generally, they're slower moving waters, impounded waters, waters that receive excessive nutrients, or where there are warming temperatures. And I understand you'll receive a report from the climate change work group, and I think in looking to the future, definitely higher temperatures, lower stream flows are on the horizon. There's been an increase in incidence of harmful algal blooms in the state. It's not clear whether that is a result of greater public awareness or if there actually are environmental factors that are changing. The Tualatin River Keepers are not proposing legislation this session, but I would like to raise our concern that the agencies who are dealing with these issues for their ongoing programs, particularly DEQ and the Water Quality Program and their TMDL program, that they receive adequate funds so that they can continue to do that important work that supports this issue. And just finally, as far as an opportunity, DEQ did receive a small grant from EPA to develop a harmful algae bloom strategy. We think this will be out sometime in the spring. It poses an opportunity for the public to participate and also the policymakers in trying to identify what our options might be to really develop a program. So thank you very much for helping to make this work group possible. And I think I'd like to also thank the agencies for their participation and all the individuals as well.
Great. Thank you. And if I'm just going to ask in the essence of time, if you can just add briefly to what Sue had to say. And again, want to thank you. I was able to attend, unfortunately, only one of the meetings at the beginning, but appreciate the work of both agencies, DHS and DEQ. This is a very important issue. I think we absolutely need to figure out what the root causes are and make sure that we resolve it, understanding that funding is a challenge, as always, but I appreciate the fact that you've been creative in trying to obtain grants, and obviously next session is going to be even more challenging, but this is a very important public health and environmental issue that we need to resolve, and it's, as we know, it has been, if anything, more of an issue over the past few years, and so I think getting at the root cause of what these recurring issues happening throughout the state, and it's happening in many districts, I know, all along the coast and in lakes across the regions. So I appreciate the work that you've done. If you can provide any brief addition to Sue's testimony, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and happy to be here this morning. I wish we didn't have to deal with this serious issue, but we do. It's important to the state, and it's important for DEQ to continue working on strategies to not only respond to but resolve harmful algae blooms and keep the public informed on those actions. The only thing that I will add is that we do Clean Water Action Plans, or TMDLs, that address nutrients that help in that front. We respond to incidents that we're seeing all over the state, whether it be in Central Oregon or on the coast or in the Portland metro area, and we respond. But however, those aren't enough, and so as we develop the work group and pull this strategy together, really look at creative ways to get in front of harmful algae blooms so that we can respond to the public and we can address inputs that might be leading to those is critically important, and we will continue to do that regardless of funding. It's a priority for DEQ, and we will certainly respond with resources and funds that we have. We're always hopeful for more, but we understand the economic climate. But this is a serious problem for the state of Oregon, and DEQ has a serious role in it. So we'll continue to support that. And I do appreciate the work of the Tualatin River Keepers and others who have worked with us so diligently to help DEQ to respond to these things. So thank you, Madam Chair, for having me here today.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for your leadership on this issue. If you want to add just a few words, and we'll have more detailed presentations during the regular session on this.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Curtis Coote. I'm manager of Healthy Waters Programs in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. The color figures that I provided you just really briefly provide some information insofar as how we work with a variety of stakeholders to develop public health advisories and then communicate with a number of other partners and the public to get the word out. Our primary goal is to protect public health with respect to harmful algae blooms. Figures 2 and 3 give you an idea about the increasing trends, in the, at least in the number of advisories. I would echo what Sue Marshall said. We think it's a combination of increased awareness and potentially environmental change. The figure on the back, figure 3, shows you kind of the extent of algae blooms just in 2010. The boxes in yellow show that there were 9 of the 22 advisories last year. 9 of those were on new water bodies that had never before had an advisory. So we're getting increased awareness, and as a result, more public health advisories. We do collect reports of illnesses. We get seafood illness reports. Exposure illnesses and veterinarian illnesses. We, once again, as the year before, we had another canine death as a result of exposure to harmful algae blooms along the South Umpqua River. So we're constantly working with members of the veterinary medical community and the public to get the word out. And as Director Peterson and Sue Marshall mentioned, we are always willing to continue to work with all of our partners and stakeholders and continue to receive guidance from this committee. Thanks.
And I appreciate the work of your agency as well, and the coordination between the two agencies is really important. I have a quick question and then sort of a quick anecdotal story, but I notice your map doesn't have anything about ocean blooms. So who is responsible for that? Is that your agency? Is that the county health? And I'd be curious about how many ocean algal blooms that we're seeing.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, the Oregon Department of Agriculture is responsible for monitoring for marine algae blooms as part of the shellfish monitoring program, and they do that in conjunction with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And at any time of the year, throughout the year, you'll see a variety of closures for different marine algal species. We do report that information, and as Sue mentioned, the kind of the focus of our program as well is on the freshwater algae blooms.
Well, I think, and we do have somebody from ODA here. I think it would be important to get this information so we can see the complete picture, because obviously that's a big part when we're talking about public health, is shellfish consumption, exposure through our beaches, you know, whether people are surfing, swimming, fishing, clamming, whatever. And yet again, this is an example of how many different agencies are involved in this, and importance to make sure they're coordinating with DHS and our local health departments to make sure that information gets out. But if we could get that information, and next time maybe we'll have ODA up here as part of the panel with ODFMW. I think it's important, and I know there's not one single agency. Well, you guys are, in some respect, coordinating it, but we need to make sure that they're all part of this whole issue. My understanding historically has just been there hasn't been great coordination between the agencies. I know you're working to remedy that, and so want to make sure that we get the full picture.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? Okay. Thank you.
You
very much. For your hard work, and we'll look forward to hearing more updates next session. If you can get that information, maybe ODA can follow up for the ocean closures. I think that would be important information for us to share. Thank you. So with that, we're going to take a quick break from our informational hearing to open up a work session for introduction of committee member measures, and then we will continue with the climate change panel after that. But we are going to be losing folks around 11:30, so just a quick update. We're going to hold over marine reserves. We have handouts on marine reserves. It's a very, very important issue that we're going to hear more about next session, but this is an issue that's going to take quite a bit of time for a presentation, and I'm afraid we're going to be a bit rushed today. So I've asked the Department of Fish and Wildlife to come back, and we'll make that a priority issue next session. or next meeting, I think, in January?
No.
In February?
February.
Okay. So we do have handouts, but this is an issue I'm going to ask my committee members to make sure and read, because we will be discussing this more in February. And then we'll have a quick update at the end on the Marine Board, and I'll have some follow-up for them as well. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open up a work session for introduction of committee measures. Senator Brzozinski?
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, and as I do this, that LC 2001, dated December 15th of this year, also LC 2750, dated 12/14 of this year.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 2001, dated 12/15/2010, and LC 2750, dated 12/14/2010. Before we go to discussion, I just want to make it clear for the record that, as you've heard here today, both of those measures need quite a bit of work. We will be holding work group sessions in January on both of them, so unfortunately, the LCs didn't come out yet in perfect form, as is often the case here, so you will see quite a bit amended version on both of those, but we are committed to work with the stakeholders, as you've heard here today, to get their input. Given the importance of making sure that these measures move forward in a timely manner, we're going to go ahead and introduce them as committee bills, and we're going to continue working on them with amendments that you'll see coming up next session. Any discussion or questions?
Madam Chair, I think just for the record, as you said, I think the one thing for those who are not familiar with this process, this is a natural process of moving legislation concepts forward. Of course, none of us that will be supporting it for the process of moving forward are bound to support something in the future. It just depends on what the final product is.
All right. Thank you, Senator Brzozinski. So with that, is there any objections? And do we need to show that two of the members are...
That will be reflected.
Excused.
Reflected, yeah, excused. If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, I will close the work session and open up the information session again for our committee. And we'll invite up the panel on climate change. And we're going to hear from Phil Moat. Phil's here somewhere.
He's right there.
Come on up, Phil.
And Kathy.
D'Lo, and then we'll also hear after that from Director Whitman and Angus Duncan.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can do better this time on our technical.
Thank you. If you don't mind, we'll get started while that's coming up. My name is Philip Mode. I'm the director at Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, and this is Kathy D'Lo, also with OCCRI, or OCRI. And we're pleased to be here to report on the report that was issued 2 weeks ago, which satisfies the bill, House Bill 3543, that created OCRI in the 2007 session. One of the things it required us to do is provide an assessment each biennium on the state of climate science as it pertains to Oregon, including physical, biological, and social science. In consultation with a Blue Ribbon panel that included Senator Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, and Gail Achterman, Director of INR, Institute for Natural Resources, and Mark Abbott, the Dean of College of Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences, we consulted on the topics, broad topics, for the report and the timeline for release, and established that there would be 9 chapters. We identified lead authors. All these people worked unpaid, took time out of their busy teaching schedules, and so on. Kathy was the leader of this effort, and she and I are going to split the time here. We had 6 lead authors from Oregon State University, 2 from Portland State University, and 1 from the U.S. Geological Survey. We had a total of 70-plus contributing authors from 4 OUS universities, as well as from agencies. All of what we used as inputs was already published work, mostly in the peer-reviewed literature, also from climate assessments previously performed by the Climate Impacts Group for the state of Washington and a Climate Action Team in California. California has already done 2 of these biennial reports as ordered by Governor Schwarzenegger. We sent the report out for peer review, even though the legislation does not require us to do that, but we felt we would get a better product, and this was a blind peer review process. We stuck to the science. There's very little in here that you could point to that reads like a recommendation. We left the adaptation framework, which you'll hear about in a moment, to make some action recommendations. Here's the outline. We'll just breeze through this very quickly. The nine chapters were augmented by a two-page legislative summary, which is required by law and was distributed by email to every member of the House and the Senate. There's also an executive summary for those who don't want to read the 400-plus page version but want a little more detail than we could fit in the two-page version. So basically what we're going through today is sort of the executive summary. Starting with Chapter 1, the observed climate change in the Northwest is pretty clear. There has been a warming in the region. The red dots on this map indicate stations where a warming trend was observed over this 1920 to 2005 study period, and there are a handful of blue dots indicating negative trends and a couple of yellow dots indicating no trend. But regionally, average warming of about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and this is clearly, if you look at where the population centers are, they don't correspond with where the big dots are. So this is not just an urbanization effect. This is a very real warming trend that's pervasive in the region. This shows simulation modeling with global climate models excerpted for the Pacific Northwest. This is from the Washington Report. Rising greenhouse gases in the 20th century fed into these climate models. As shown on the top panel, the gray area with the black line, that produces a warming of about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, just as observed. So we can say that the observed warming is consistent with rising greenhouse gases. The gray shading indicates the band of variability in the model simulations for 20th century. And then going into the future, using different scenarios of greenhouse gas concentrations from as sort of low sustainability scenario, that's the yellow or B1, to a higher, but by no means highest of the ones being considered. So the range of future warming could be anywhere from 2 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, but a central estimate is about 5 degrees, so that's about 0.5 degree Fahrenheit per decade. In the out years, the later decades, the amount of warming depends very much on the amount of greenhouse gases that we pump into the atmosphere, that we, the human race, not we, the authors of the report. The bottom panel shows a similar graph for precipitation, and really the story is annual mean precipitation is not expected to change in the Northwest, but we do expect enhanced seasonality with somewhat drier and warmer conditions in summer. Other seasons, the models are equivocal about changes in precipitation. But our judgment, based on various studies of observed changes in extreme precipitation and a very limited study of future changes, is that it's likely that there will be more extreme precipitation in the future. Chapter 2 covered sources of greenhouse gases in Oregon. Very interesting comparisons of Oregon with the rest of the country. We, of course, have low per capita emissions. That's partly because of our heavy reliance on hydropower, but also because of the urban density in Portland and heavy use of transit there. The largest sector in Oregon, as most people know who've looked at climate change in Oregon, is transportation. And that's largely passenger vehicles. The story with water supply in Oregon on Chapter 3 is told in part by this map of simulation modeling by Heejun Chung, a professor at Portland State, showing the spring snow amount in the Willamette River Basin. And so you can see the Cascades lighting up blue on the right. That's heavy snow, and then going out from the 20th century on the left to mid-21st century in the middle and late 21st century on the right, you can see that spring snowpack really diminishing with warming. And that translates into the hydrograph for the Willamette River shown here. The 20th century flow has a bit of a spring snowmelt peak. The letters on the bottom indicate the months. And so the blue curve shows fairly sustained flows from January through about June, rainfall first and then snowmelt, with a little bit of warming, that snowmelt pulse goes away, and the green and red curves are very much a rain-dominant basin with very little contribution from snowmelt. And that, of course, increases the risk of flooding and of low flows in the summer. Agriculture in Oregon, we have a number of crops that are grown for which Oregon is the number one grower in the country, and these include things like hazelnuts and grass seed. Some of these crops are you know, uniquely suited to Oregon's combination of climate and soils, and could be at risk from changes in water supply or climate. Agriculture is a small participant in Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. There's both concerns and pluses on agriculture. The one big concern, of course, is the availability of water with warmer, drier summers and a reduction in summer water supply from reduced snow melt. Also, weeds prefer a higher CO2 atmosphere, many of them. So even though most plants grow better with more CO2, weeds grow much, much better with more CO2. Invasive insects are another concern. The pluses, longer growing season with higher temperatures and more wine varieties. This shows the range of temperatures preferred by a bunch of different wine grapes. This is by Greg Jones at Southern Oregon University. And Willamette Valley, of course, is prime Pinot Noir territory right now, but as temperatures slide more to the right, you can see a much larger number of grapes can be grown here. And a lot of wineries are starting to look at that. And the climate of the Napa Valley, which is now in that sort of ideal zone of 17 to 19 degrees Celsius with a, you know, quite a large number of wine grapes that thrive in that climate, if you warm up a couple more degrees, you see all they'll be able to grow is table grapes and raisins. So Willamette will be the new Napa Valley in the late 21st century. And Kathy's going to take it from there.
Thanks, Phil. Chapter 5 looked at Oregon's vegetation and how it may change under a warming climate. The top panel is what vegetation looked like at the end of the 20th century here in Oregon. No surprises, forest in western Oregon, shrubland in eastern Oregon, and these subalpine forests up in the Oregon Cascades. But the bottom two panels show vegetation under a warming climate. The left one is a less greenhouse gas intensive scenario, so less warming, and the right one is more greenhouse gas intensive scenario. And in that aggressive warming scenario, you see most of the maritime evergreen needleleaf forest disappear, except for in extreme northwest Oregon. And also this subtropical mixed forest moves in on the south to central coast. And also we would expect that wildfires would increase. Warmer, drier summers are fuel for wildfires here in western Oregon. And these graphics show the change in biomass burned, the future minus the present. The left one is, again, that less intensive warming scenario, and the right one is the more intensive warming scenario. And in western Oregon, wildfires are projected to increase by quite a bit by the end of the 21st century. Chapter 6 was a coastal chapter, and Washington and California both looked at sea level rise, but they didn't cover the coast the way that we did. We definitely looked at sea level rise, but we also looked at other processes that affect the coast, erosion and flooding. But here is a graphic of sea level rise in Oregon at the end of the 20th century. Global mean sea level rise has risen, but in Oregon, relative sea level rise is different along the coast because parts are moving up from geologic uplift. So the blue arrows show places along the Oregon coast where sea level rise is exceeding that geologic uplift. But by the middle of the 21st century, we're expecting all of these arrows to be blue, and sea level rise will be greater than that of geologic uplift. And this is just a picture showing coastal erosion that's happening now on the Oregon coast. This is shoreline retreat and armoring in Rockaway. And if you look to the middle of the picture, you see that they had to riprap this development area because they had constant erosion and flooding problems. So it's just an analog for what might happen in the future with climate change. Chapter 7 was a very well-written, very comprehensive look at Oregon's fish and wildlife species. We're one of the most ecologically diverse states in the country, so we would expect that these species would be vulnerable in a warming climate. And we've observed some species changes in the end of the 20th century. It's a little too soon to say if it's climate change. It could be natural variability, but it certainly provides a picture of what might happen under a warming climate. We've seen insects moving in from the south that we haven't had before, and frogs reproducing earlier in the year. Land birds and other species are shifting their distributions northward toward the coast and upslope. Freshwater fish are losing their habitats as the waters get warmer, and Humboldt squid have started appearing off the Oregon coast. They're mostly a tropical, subtropical kind of marine animal, and they're very predatory, and we've started seeing them in the past few years. And it's somewhat fortuitous that there was an algal bloom presentation right before us, but these are the algal blooms that have been measured in along the Oregon coast, and the right bars show shellfish closures frequency over two time periods, but it's mostly the end of the 20th century and this decade. And you can see that there have been up to 25%, 35% shellfish closures because of these toxins that affect shellfish along the Oregon coast. And these happen because of warmer water, and we would expect that to increase with climate change. Certainly, everything that we've outlined for you comes with an economic risk. We try to tackle an economic assessment of climate change in Oregon, but it's a very, very large undertaking, and we weren't completely able to do it, but we talk about what we think might happen, and we call for a greater economic assessment in the future. The cost of inaction for global climate change, global estimates are 1 to 5 gross domestic products. Some estimates have that as high as 20%, but that's a very, very terrible scenario, and you would never let it get that far. And the things that might hurt Oregon economically are these reductions in snow and water supply, energy production. A lot of our energy is produced by hydropower, and as we saw in that hydrograph a few slides back, winter flows may rise, so energy production might go up in the winter, but summer flows will decrease, and there will be less energy production during the summer, which is when we use a lot of energy because we're cooling our houses. Agriculture, crop yield, and water supply, Phil talked about that. Forestry, as wildfire might increase in western Oregon, we also might see insects and other disturbances moving in and shifting species, which I covered in the vegetation chapter. Riverine and coastal flooding will impact all sorts of sectors, including recreation and tourism. And the Climate Leadership Initiative covered these business-as-usual cases in salmon health and recreation. Chapter 9, we tried to figure out how Oregonians think about climate change. What do they think about climate change? And this comes from a survey on renewable energy from that was distributed, and they tacked on a few climate change questions. So it goes from do not know as number one to climate change is a serious problem, significant energy policy changes are needed. So almost a quarter of Oregonians, not a quarter, three quarters of Oregonians think that climate change is a serious problem and some sort of policy should happen to reduce our dependence on greenhouse gas fuels. Key findings, this is all outlined in the legislative summary. Increases in annual temperature, warmer, drier summers. This will save you from reading the 400-page report. Summer water supply will decrease, and that will be as a result of reduced snowpack and drier summers. Oregon's most greenhouse gas-intensive sector is transportation, and availability, quality, and cost of water will be a limiting factor for agriculture. There are some opportunities in the ag sector. We could have some great new wines here in Oregon. Wildfire is projected to increase. Coastal flooding may increase in the future, and we may have to riprap our shores like we saw in that one picture. All sorts of plant and animal species will have to shift their distributions to more hospitable habitats, and changes to the marine environment, including increased temperatures. Like I said, we call for a more complete economic analysis of climate change on Oregon's economy. We couldn't adequately cover it in this report, but it's certainly an important issue. We're already experiencing impacts now, so we say that measures for adaptation should be taken now. So we worked closely with the Oregon Climate Change Adaptation Framework, which Richard Whitman will talk about in a second. And thank you. We'd be happy to take any questions.
It's a lot. All right. First of all, I want to thank you for your leadership on this. It's come a long way since it's been almost, I think, year since we had that meeting. And I have read the executive summary. I was planning over the holidays to read the 400-page report, as I was saying to my staff. She's like, okay.
But,
yeah. It's really important information, and I just want to encourage my colleagues to at least make sure and read the executive summary. But obviously there's been a lot of time and effort put into this. I'm hoping also, and I know we're going to hear from Director Whitman about the adaptation portions and how he's working with all the state agencies to make sure that this information is adopted in their practices, which I think is really important. One of the things I want to make sure happens is, as the Integrated Water Resources Strategy moves forward, that this information is presented to them, because the water supply component is very, very important as we look at agricultural, municipal needs, industrial needs, domestic needs of the future. I think that's going to be a big component of our doing our future planning. And also, as you know, we had a small, I shouldn't say small, but a work group on the transportation component, which still needs a lot of work, as you've indicated here. So there's many missing pieces, I think, that we still need to work on at the legislative end, and appreciate this very important information. I want to see if there's any comments or questions from my colleagues before we call up the rest of the panel.
No, very impressive.
Yeah, very impressive. And Phil, I know you've only been here about a year, so the fact that you've taken this on in such a short time, both of you, appreciate that. We'll look forward to working with you and hearing more next session.
Thank you, Senator Ding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have a couple more folks that are going to talk about what's happening in climate change in the state. Angus, and then we also have Director Whitman. He's going to come up. I don't know who wants to go first. Okay.
Thank you. Yep.
Okay. Director, welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, Richard Whitman, Director of the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. And if you'd bear with me for just a second here.
All coming out of your time, Richard.
Yeah, thanks. So I think given the timing, what I'm going to do is not show you the PowerPoint. I've handed out hard copies of the PowerPoint presentation to you. So I'm just going to walk through that. I'm going to try to give you a five-minute version of the presentation. There are copies, hard copies of the PowerPoint presentation on the back table for people in the audience who want to follow along as well. So again, Richard Whitman for the record. My presentation is of work that has been done by a group of Oregon state agencies that was tasked by Oregon Governor Kulongoski about a year ago to work with the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute and take the State of the Science report that you just heard about and do a version 1.0 of what are the implications of that report in terms of the science for Oregon's, for the people of Oregon and the communities in Oregon. So the work that I'm presenting to you today is very much not the product of the Department of Land Conservation. It's the product of a group of about 20 state agencies and Oregon University System entities that work together with the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute to take their science information and translate it into some initial recommendations for policy for how Oregon should begin preparing for climate change. This is also, Angus Duncan is going to talk about how we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This report really focuses on the fact that we are going to see increases in temperature, we are going to see changes in precipitation and water supply in Oregon, regardless of what happens in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So we need to begin work on the preparation and adaptation side, regardless of what happens on the greenhouse gas reduction side. So The purposes, moving to, I think it's the third slide of the presentation, the purposes of the framework are to identify the major risk for Oregonians in terms of climate change and to provide an organizational framework for how state, local, and federal and private sectors should work together to begin preparing. Secondarily, to also assess the capacity that we currently have to deal with some of these issues and to really identify next steps. Part of the context for this work is also been the recognition that we're in an economic and fiscal situation where there are not going to be resources, new resources to work on these issues. So we need to look at this in terms of how do we redirect and prioritize existing resources to start at least taking the next steps for dealing with these issues. And so that's very much the approach. So what I'm going to do now is jump to the portions of this presentation that are the tables, the colored tables that you have in your handouts. The framework organizes the risk that you just heard about from Phil Moat and Kathy Dello into 11 major categories, and then broke those down further into risks that we and they, the scientists, believe are very likely to occur, and a third category more likely than not to occur. That third category is one that there's still a fair amount of uncertainty about. In terms of the risks that are likely to occur, we then looked at what's the low-hanging, low-cost, or no-cost things that we can start doing to prepare for some of those risks. So first of all, obviously most directly with climate change is an increase in average temperature, but also an increase in extreme heat events. And we, if you think back to a year from last July, we had a week of temperatures at 110 and even above in the Willamette Valley is a good example of that sort of phenomenon that we believe will become more frequent. So part of this work was, this is not just work of the natural resource agencies. We also had Oregon Department of Transportation and Public Health very much involved in this. So this first action is really a public health action directed at maintaining and improving our capacity to provide places for people to go in a extreme heat event to, if they don't have air conditioning, and making sure that we have systems in place for that.
Director Roybon, I was at the movies basically that entire week.
You were shot.
Which is over air conditioned, which is another issue. But yes, we did not have air conditioning.
And Chair Dingfelder, just a little anecdote. My commission was on the Oregon coast. And actually, there was a deluge of people coming from the from the Willamette Valley over to the coast to escape from that heat event. And you know, there were no hotel rooms to be had anywhere on the Oregon coast at that time. So again, that's the sort of thing I think we can expect more of. The second most likely type of effect, and one that we need to begin preparing for, is effects on hydrology. And here there are really two effects. You've heard about the decrease in snowpack that we're already seeing. And a lot of our storage in Oregon is from snowpack, but also increased incidence of seasonal drought, particularly during the summer and early fall. That the main impact of that is really for irrigated agriculture in Oregon. So starting to work with the agricultural community to look at new sources of storage, to look at both natural storage and artificial storage, and to look at incentives for water conservation were all thought to be very important actions. This does relate directly to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. Water Resources has participated actively in this effort, and there's a direct link to the work that they're doing there. I'm only going to hit a couple of the next ones in respect for Angus here and leave him a little bit of time, but I'm giving you a little bit of the flavor of some of the actions. So in the likely to occur wildfire, both intensity and frequency, We have some planning processes and building codes work that's been done in terms of responding to risk from wildfire, but we believe there's substantially more work to do, both on the land use planning side and also on the development standard side in order to reduce risk to the built environment from wildfire. The fourth category is ocean, increase in ocean temperature and acidification. You heard about the algal blooms. There's not a whole lot, frankly, in terms of actions that we've came up with that's low-hanging fruit on this one. This is really more of a global issue, obviously, but we do need some increased research and monitoring in this area to have a sense of the impacts on some of our fisheries industries and communities on the Oregon coast.
And just a quick question, as far as mapping that's been done?
Yes.
Through the Coastal Zone Management Program, or I'm assuming that most of that's already been done for the coast, or as far as areas of inundation, I know we've been looking at that for quite a while, but if you could just comment on what's being done at the local level to respond.
Yes, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. So on mapping, the main effort that's going on right now is to take some of the old mapping that we have and really update it with much better information in terms of LIDAR mapping on the Oregon coast. The main, as you heard from Kathy Dello, the main risk on the Oregon coast is not really sea level rise in Oregon. It is increased wave height and erosion resulting from increased wave height and storms. And we're seeing that already. There's been a very significant increase in wave height already. So we are working with some specific communities, some specific communities have really taken the initiative to begin working on these risks themselves. Those are going to present planning challenges, infrastructure challenges, and potentially some fairly significant cost to the state.
Right.
So I'm going to end there. You have copies of the executive summary of this report. I'll just note that the full report is available on the main page of the department's website. And in normally I wouldn't tell people to go look at the main report, but ours is only
especially legislators.
Ours is only 100 pages long, and if you really want to know the detail of the recommended next steps, it really is in the main report. There's actually a piece entitled "Next Steps" where you can get some of the details on these things. So with that, I'll conclude. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for the director? Before I move over to Angus, I just want to thank you for your leadership on this. This has been an incredible effort as far as coordination among the agencies. And one of the things, of course, that, you know, with 14 different natural resource agencies in the state, we do have a challenge in coordination, making sure that the agencies are on the same page. So I appreciate the leadership that you've provided and your
thank
agency's
you.
Work. And I know that we didn't provide you with a lot of extra funding to do this, so and all the agencies that were involved, I will
that's
say,
right.
Because it's been a huge effort. This is very valuable information, and we will be looking very carefully at these recommendations.
Thank you.
Angus.
Richard, thank you.
Get to conclude here on this panel.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation and chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I do want to express Greg Cantor's regrets. He was able to come down for the House hearing yesterday, but he was unable to make this one today, so all you get today is me. And I will also pass on the PowerPoint, summarize the package that I just gave you, most of which is included there just so you can see some of the breadth of the recommendations that are going to be coming forward. Essentially, if Dr. Moat's presentation was the diagnosis and Richard's was the symptomatic treatment, what our commission focused on this year was trying to find a cure, as it were. And And so our recommendations go to entirely to how we reduce greenhouse gases as a state and prepare ourselves to fit into a national strategy as and when one emerges. And I will try to just give you a couple of takeaways from this process, but I will tell you it's a process that was nearly a year-long one. Some 100 folks, some of them technical experts, some of them stakeholder groups, NGOs, business, labor, all worked through the summer and into the fall to develop these recommendations. They were brought to our commission in October. We debated them over 2 meetings and ended up adopting the roadmap unanimously. Because we had even less funding than Richard, our report will be even shorter than Richard's and even more accessible and readable. But I will just summarize it here. If you go to the third slide in what I gave you, you'll see that the historical and projected emissions in Oregon were basically creeping up at about 1% a year since 1990. We adopted some initial recommendations, the governor did, subsequently the legislature, starting in 2004, and essentially we are hitting our 2010 goal, the one that you set for us, which was to arrest that upward creep and even bend the line down a little bit. The bad news is if you don't keep bending the line down, it starts bending back up almost immediately. And so if you go to the next chart, you see, again, there's some good news there. It shows that although our population is growing and our GDP until recently was also growing as a state and as a nation, so were our emissions. They were growing more slowly. We are becoming a less carbon-intensive nation and economy, but they have to stop growing and start shrinking, and that line, the bottom line on that chart is the harder news. That's the line that ultimately we have to be able to get onto. Couple more slides forward. Essentially, takeaway number one is you don't get down to that lower line unless you stop thinking incrementally and start thinking transformationally. There have to be some big changes as well as a host of small changes. Clearly, some of those have to be at the national level. There has to be a national regulatory commitment to reducing carbon and to funding the kind of technology innovation that enables us to reach for that line. And within Oregon, we have to be prepared to use both those tools when they emerge, particularly leveraging our state and local regulatory and planning authorities. So a good parallel would be if we can't drive vehicle technology toward more carbon efficiency, we can certainly help, we can certainly lead, but what we have to do is be prepared with, for example, the infrastructure to support that new technology and with the urban design and growth management policies that basically leverage that technology into the kinds of reductions you have to see. So the seventh slide in is the one I'm going to stop with. It shows out of the 200 or so recommendations, 8 of what we would call, I guess, big ideas or big changes. And I'm going to summarize these as well. So the second and the fourth go particularly to transportation and land use, our largest emissions sector. And it says, and I think we will end up confirming this with ODOT analysis this year, that the way we push those emissions down are by converting the fleet from diesel and gasoline to electricity, natural gas, and biofuels, that we constrain growth within the 6 metropolitan planning areas, the 6 largest urban areas in the state. And our recommendation is to hold ourselves to no net expansion of the urban growth boundary in those 6 areas. That's a pretty challenging proposition, and I know a pretty provocative one, but that we think is one of the conditions for achieving this kind of compactness and efficiency in urban design that will deliver the savings. On electricity, 2 things really. One is ramp down coal so that, sometime between now and 2050 and preferably sooner rather than later, we're not receiving any of our electricity from coal except possibly some spot purchases of system power. The Boardman agreement that the EQC has achieved and that we think will be ratified by EPA and the PUC is a real offer, is a door that's opening to us to start to replicate that kind of conversion of the rest of the coal fleet that serves Oregon over the next 10 to 20 years. And so there's going to be a lot of focus on that. Buildings are about 40% of our energy consumption in the state, and therefore a significant factor in reducing emissions. So we're looking at getting to new building designs that are essentially zero carbon emission designs, and for all of the existing stock to develop a retrofit code that achieves significant savings there and that can be applied on a obligatory basis at point of sale. The one other thing I think I will just finger and then I will close is that we will start to look at a different way of calculating our carbon emissions, so we're not just looking at emissions that originate in this state. We're looking at emissions that we cause, even if the emissions don't occur in this state. As we offshore production, as we are a net importer of goods and services, the emissions associated with those goods and services are really our responsibility. Right now, we do look at that with respect to electricity. We count emissions that are released in Montana and Wyoming for electricity that's imported to the state. We need to look at the other goods and services that we import, the carbon profile of those, and figure out how we manage those as well. And the last thing that we need to do is we need to come up with a kind of a least cost planning technique for looking at the opportunities, the costs, and the chronology for achieving reductions across these six different sectors that we've looked at. Clearly, we can get some reductions sooner and less expensively in some places, fewer reductions and probably further out in time in other circumstances. And right now, we don't have any way to sort those, so we're simply saying, you know, push on reductions equally in each one of these sectors. But that's the wrong way to do it. As we've learned in electrical planning, if you do least cost planning, you can achieve a lot more, and you can achieve it much more cost effectively. And we need to be able to apply that to carbon reductions as well. Done.
Thank you. Any questions before I make a few comments on the panel? All right. Well, I want to thank you, Angus, because similar to Director Whitman, you had a huge charge with a very limited budget and staff, which I think was close to zero.
Approximately zero.
And the amount of time and effort that you and the members of this group put in donated time, because certainly there are many, many people who donated their time for input. Again, it's very impressive, the work that's been done. Given the absence of federal legislation, I think it is coming on us at the state level to continue to be a leader on this issue, both at the within our own agencies and looking at policies that can help shape the future of reductions of greenhouse gases. Certainly, I'm committed, and our committee is committed to make sure that happens. So we look forward to working with you both. Next session, as we look at how we can implement some of these recommendations, I think is really important. The work that's been done the past year is just amazing, frankly. And again, given the limited resources that we've had, very, very impressive. So I applaud all of the work that's been done. I appreciate all the hard thinking that's gone into it, and look forward to working with you next session.
And Madam Chair, if I just may say, while we had no state dollars in our budget, we could not have done the work we did without really exemplary support from the state agencies, Richards and everybody else's. So there was a lot of state agency effort that went into our package as well.
Right, and I should say, I know that the governor-elect is committed to make sure that this work continues, and we'll look forward to working with him. I've had conversations already, and certainly look forward to working with him as we figure out how we can continue to move forward. Given the challenge with the economy, I think we have to remember that this is also an economic development opportunity for the state of Oregon, as we've been a leader on many of these technologies. So I think it is, again, an important for us to continue to move forward and figure out how we're going to address some of these challenges, make sure that we continue to be a leader, and I think there's some real opportunities here for Oregon to move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And last but not least, before I lose my last member, who's here for a couple more minutes, I'm going to ask the director of the Marine Board to just come up. I'd ask him to provide a brief update on the Holgate channel issue. And then, as I mentioned, the Marine reserves will be held over because we do need more time for that. It's a very important issue. So I'm going to ask Director Bruin to come up. I will, before you give your update, I am going to just bring this up because I've read this report, which, frankly, I found this audit rather appalling, about the practices of the Marine Board. I will be asking you to come back in February and give a detailed response. I did see the letter that was a response. I realize you were not the director at the time, but it's unfortunate that so many of the practices went on for as long as they did. All the committee members have a copy of that report, which I've asked them to read in detail, so I will be asking you to come back at the beginning of the session with responses, and I will be setting up some meetings to talk about it. So I'm not going to ask you to talk about it at this point because we don't have time. So if you can provide an update on the issue that we discussed, and then we'll be following up with responses to the audit.
Happy to do so.
Thank you.
Do I just put this in?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's underneath the side one there.
It's underneath. Yeah.
Oh, you already have it on here. Let's see.
I think you just have to click on it.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Debbie, can you help some?
It's coming.
You got it? Okay.
Good morning, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Bruin, the director of the Oregon State Marine Board. With me is Randy Henry, our policy analyst. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and talk a little bit about the Holgate Channel and Ross Island Lagoon and provide an update for what has been done so far. Here's a picture of Ross Island, the Holgate Channel, and the lagoon. The Holgate Channel runs to the east side of Ross Island. The main channel running to the west. At the bottom is East Island, which we'll be talking about a little bit later.
And for my colleagues' benefit, this is on the Willamette River in Portland, not in my district, but in a neighboring Senate district. And
sorry,
Senator
about that.
Rosenbaum and Senator Burdick, I believe.
And a couple of pictures from the boater's view of being in the Holgate Channel. So I'd like to give you a brief history of how we arrived to where we're at right now. In March 2009, Willamette Riverkeepers, Audubon Society, and Urban Green Spaces Institute petitioned the board to establish a non-motorized area within the lagoon and a slow-no-wake zone within the Holgate Channel. That petition was later modified as a slow-no-wake zone for both the channel and the lagoon. In the July 2009 board meeting, staff conducted public meetings and made a recommendation to the board at the July 2009 meeting. Based on the public input that we received, we recommended a slow-no-wake zone for the lagoon and a slow-no-wake zone for the channel south of the entrance to the lagoon. The staff recommendation was based on attempting to find middle ground between testimony of the motorized and the non-motorized communities. The lagoon is an area where there's a great deal of habitat restoration work, and at peak times can become saturated with both motorized and non-motorized boats. The channel north of the lagoon is wider, it's deeper, it's a good area for other water sports than the south side of the Holgate Channel. There were a number of concerns discussed at that board meeting, particularly in relation to the Holgate Channel, and the board voted at that point not to approve any of the staff recommendations. The board reopened the issue at the October board meeting, approved a slow no-wake zone within the lagoon and then asked the staff to put together a working group to look at can we find some common ground within the Holgate channel and to propose some rules for that channel separately. So between February and June, the work group met five times to try to reach consensus on how best to deal with the Holgate channel. The group was unable to achieve consensus on rulemaking. However, they did develop a list of generally supported action items, which are on the next slide, and I'll show you in a moment. So we presented that to the board at the June 2010 meeting. The board supported the interim action items and requested that we bring a rule change to them at the October board meeting. So here are the action items that were approved by the board. They asked for access point signage at access points into the lagoon, notifying boaters that it is a slow no-wake area. The work group requested that rack cards be developed and distributed in the Portland area to encourage shared and respectful use by boaters, as well as remind them that there are penalties for unsafe operation. The rack cards also included recommendations for safe and respectful operations for both power boats and non-motorized boats. The Oregon State Marine Board was asked to work with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to develop a plan to increase presence during high use times. We were also asked to send a letter to the City of Portland. The Marine Board, under statute, we regulate boat motor noise but don't regulate general noise by statute. So one of the outcomes of the work group was to send a letter to the city to see if they wanted to put together a noise ordinance. One of the concerns that was brought up was stereo noise coming from the wakeboard boats, particularly when you put speakers up on the mounted towers. It creates a lot of noise, and so that was one of the things the group wanted to look at. The group then asked the Marine Board to monitor the conflict and see if these measures had the desired effect. So here's the actions that have been completed to date, and I will say the board meeting occurred at the end of June, and we wanted to get more done before the summer or during the summer, and we really feel like we were a little bit short in doing so, but here's what has been accomplished so far. We did get rack cards distributed to the Portland area. These are the rack cards, and I handed those out as well, what the rack cards look like, so you do have those. We did work with Multnomah County on a response plan to try to get more law enforcement in the lagoon during the high use times. With the Kyron Horman situation this summer, a lot of resources went to that, and we did not get the resources put into the Holgate Channel and Ross Island like we would have liked to. We have had conversations with Multnomah County, and they are definitely committed to increasing patrol presence for next summer.
So were there any enforcement actions during this past summer?
Interestingly, the summer was pretty quiet. The fall, there was a lot of activity and concerns that occurred during the fall between motorized and non-motorized. But the summer itself was a little bit slower. Kind of an odd summer, pretty cold start. Mm-hmm. And we did send a letter to the City of Portland. So the actions are completed. As you can see, there's a sign going in. We did have the signs put in at the lagoon. You can see they're in their rain slickers, so this didn't happen until October that we finally got the signs put in. Because Ross Island Sand and Gravel runs that area, we had to work with them to find a location that was suitable that they approved of, and we were able to find a location and have the signs put in. We also had a larger poster board type material signs put together that can be put up at clubs or at businesses to show some of the same information that's on the rack cards. At the October 2010 board meeting, the board directed staff to move forward on rulemaking. So what we proposed to the board to move forward with is a prohibition on wake-enhancing devices in the Holgate Channel, and establishing a slow no-wake zone for an area south of a point 200 feet north of East Island. So this splits the southern part of Holgate Channel kind of in half, where the northern part you could have a wake and the southern part would be a no-wake zone. So the future actions, in July we have public meetings for the proposed rules. We're already working with Multnomah County to develop a law enforcement plan. The signs for Holgate Channel, or we're going to complete installation for signs on the channel. The signs going into the lagoon are completed. We'll continue to distribute the rack cards more broadly. We're also making some changes to things like the boater handbook. We've modified that to address some of the user conflict issues, to be mindful of your wake, to be respectful when you're out on the water. That is some of the things that we're pushing to try to get boaters themselves to work with one another and be respectful on the waterway.
So, question, January, so public meeting, that's not going to be a series of meetings, it's just one meeting for the proposed rule?
So we'll have the proposed rule meeting on January 20th, and then we have a special board meeting on February 17th, where they'll look at any rulemaking action at that point, and that'll be open for public comment as well.
Okay, so you'll have draft rules available before the meeting? You're going to present those at the January meeting?
The draft rules are already out, correct?
Right, yeah.
I need to make sure that I see those. And if you could make sure and notify my office about when the public meeting is. So certainly like to notify my constituents.
Yes, ma'am. So in closing, the Holgate Channel has been an interesting one because it does deal with user conflict, but it has been an opportunity for us as the Marine Board to engage with and have conversations as we broaden how we address the larger boating community. I think from the board's perspective and the staff's perspective at the Marine Board, it has provided definitely opportunities to have conversations and to look at how do we share the waterways and what parts does the Marine Board play in a leadership role in ensuring that everyone that's using the waterway can use it in a way that supports the type of activity that they're wanting to use. So any questions?
Again, just making sure that my office, because the hearings are very, or this site is very close to my district, so I want to make sure that I get the information out. But appreciate the fact that you're revisiting this. Certainly, I know you've heard from a lot of constituents that they were not very pleased with the first outcome, and so I appreciate the fact that the board has gone back and revisiting it. As far as the timing, if these rules are adopted, say, in February, then obviously I'm assuming they'd be in place for the next season coming up, because I think that was a big question.
And that was part of the reason that we had a special board meeting in February, so we weren't waiting until the next board meeting to have something else happen, because the quarterly board meetings tend to push things off and not get done as quickly as we would like.
Okay. All right. I think that's all the questions I have for now. As I mentioned, we'll have you back in February to provide a detailed response to the audit report that we received and to hear how your agency is responding to that. Like I said, we do have the written letter, but I'd like to have a detailed presentation. And I'm sure we'll be in touch before then because of the rulemaking process. So appreciate both of you coming here today.
Thank you.
I look forward to working with you. With that, we will be closing the Senate Environment Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and we will be reconvening in February next year.
Yeah, a short meeting in January, but just to organize.
Yes, we have a short organizational meeting in January, but we won't be hearing anything substantively at that point. Look forward to working with you all next year.